Hey, BattleTech fans, thank you for tuning in for this second part of the first episode of the Renegade HPG podcast. If you didn't catch that first part, don't worry. These two definitely act very independently. That first part really talked about kind of the history and legacy of the game. And this episode is going to talk a lot more about the gameplay. So how to build a deck, basic tactics. We'll go through all the cards for you guys. And so you can kind of watch either or both. In that first episode, we did talk about sideboarding in that one, which could be applicable for gameplay. So you might want to check that out if you're interested kind of on the tournament side of things and that sideboard. But that's really only applicable for that kind of narrow use. But otherwise, I hope you guys enjoy this. Please feel free to put comments down below. If you have any questions about rules or sets that we don't cover in this video, we'll be happy to kind of keep an eye on that and answer them if they pop up. And otherwise, enjoy the video and we'll catch you on the tail end.
That's a perfect transition into kind of the second half of, you know, what we chat about talking about here, was just, you know, talking about the gameplay, you know. Mm-hmm. So we've kind of done, you know, we've talked about the history a little bit, but let's like kind of dive into that to that gameplay.
Sure.
Certainly for my questions, I've kind of, you know, recently getting back into the game, you know, what is the best way to kind of get started again? You know, what do you need? What is kind of that basic need of cards, either number or type, and where are you getting them? And, you know, what are those kind of first, you know, if you listen to this podcast and by chance you weren't a player already, you know, what is that starting intro point?
The biggest hurdle is what to collect. Okay, during its course of its life, there were only about 850 individual different cards that were made. Of those, I would say a third are unusable, or, you know, not.
Let's say a quarter are strictly unusable.
Yes, at least a quarter of those are strictly unusable. Agreed, 100%. So that narrows down your basic cards. But if you're not familiar with the game, you don't know what those cards are. And so basically try to pick up decks if you can that are pre-made. Those are few and far between. And so you're left with buying, you know, just bulk anything you can and then trying to figure out on your own. And that makes life difficult.
I think you want to speak to two separate players and give them two separate types of players. The first type of player is a player who's willing to try using the computerized versions. And the second type of player is the player who insists on feeling the cardboard beneath their fingers. The first type of player actually has a lot of options, because in the world of computer-based play, there are no card restrictions. You can go on.
There's no rarity.
Right. You can go to the Facebook group, go to the announcements. By the way, this is a plug. Read the announcements in the Facebook group. I cannot tell you the number of times I answer questions from people new to the group, who the answer to whose questions are contained in the announcements that they didn't read or didn't see. So read the announcements. In the announcements, you will find two separate platforms that will allow you to play the game. One is called Lackey and one is called Tabletop Simulator. So let's talk about them. Lackey is a two-dimensional, stripped down interface for card games that is quite old and allows you to sort of design and create your own plugins. There has been a plugin for Lackey for a long time, but we've rehabilitated it, improved it, and you can download Lackey and you can play today.
Is that link in the Facebook group?
It's in the announcements in the Facebook group. Yes.
And so for people searching, that's BattleTech CCG is the name of the
Facebook group is BattleTech CCG.
And then also recommending, you know, new players get into that BattleTech CCG trade and sell page if they are fond of having the cardboard in their hands.
Right.
But we'll
put links in the show notes for those as well. Now, if you are willing to do this on the computer, what you will find in Lackey is you will find 13 pre-generated decks made by SillyWiz, our very own Mark Roberts, mm-hmm. that are all of a vaguely similar level of play and are designed to introduce players to various aspects of the gameplay. So you have 13 decks already there at your fingertips that you can play with. And from there, building facility with the way the game works, if you want to jump into card collecting, you at least have an idea of what you're looking for, right? What cards work, what cards don't, what factions interest you, and what factions don't. And then we can talk about the actual purchasing, the world of purchasing in a bit. But I also want to give a shout out to the Tabletop Simulator way to play. Now, Tabletop Simulator is a three-dimensional game playing experience that you can get off Steam that gives you access to like a huge range of plugins for playing games from Axis and Allies to Magic the Gathering, or maybe not Magic the Gathering, to Battletech CCG, to Descent, to like just about any board game you can think of. Somebody's made a plugin for like little 3D pieces that you can move around a table. And Tabletop Simulator really feels like the digital equivalent of physical slinging cards, right? Because the cards flip and you can move deck objects around. And you could even do it in virtual reality if you happen to have that stuff. So there are some people who swear by Lackey because it's stripped down and simple and their computer cannot run Tabletop Simulator very easily, or they have trouble with the physical manipulation of the cards in TTS. And there are some people who swear by TTS because it's got more sort immersive. Of a tactile, yeah, more immersive and more of a tactile feel. Now, if you're playing Tabletop Simulator, there are three or four different plugins for Battletech CCG, and this is a problem. The reason it's a problem is that it makes it hard to bring the community is already relatively fragmented. What we ultimately want is one Battletech CCG plugin, and we want everybody to use it.
Right.
I have put most of my efforts behind the development of a particular Battletech CCG plugin, which I'm one of the owners of, but I'm not like the primary designer of. You will also find it referenced in the announcements of the Facebook group. I definitely believe that it is the best one out there. Now, what does the TTS lack? TTS lacks two things. The first thing it lacks is a good deck editor. If you want to do deck editing, i.e. you want to do something like, I know I'm playing Comstar and I'm looking for fast mechs that I can put in a Comstar deck. What are my choices? So I need to filter down to fast mechs that are either Comstar or Inner Sphere generic, right? And I don't want to go through all 800 cards. I just want to see the 10 that are available to me. And then I want to cut out all of them that cost 4 or more because I'm looking for something in a particular price range. So I've got multiple filters. There are two good places to do that. One of them is Lackey. Lackey has an excellent deck editing experience. The other one is an offline program for Windows called Mordell's Deck Builder. And you can also find this in the Facebook group in the files. It is an old program. I've badgered Mordell any number of times for the source code. He's lost it. So but it still functions. It's a Win32 program. You can probably run it on Apple Macs for however you run Win32 programs on Macs. It's an excellent deck editor. Tabletop Simulator does not have a good deck editing experience because it's not clear how you would filter cards based on traits. If anybody out there watching this is a programmer or someone who wants to help, figuring out how to contribute a deck editing experience to the Battletech CCG plugin is something we would very much love. Drop us a line. But building a deck and Tabletop Simulator is really going to feel like building a deck somewhere else and then finding the cards in Tabletop Simulator and dragging them to a deck. The other thing that Tabletop Simulator lacks, so I said deck editing. It lacks the pre-generated decks that Lackey has. Now, depending on when you might be listening to it, we may fix that. But as of the time of taping, we don't have those pre-gen decks in the Tabletop Simulator plugin. So that is a quick overview of the online world. And again, if you're a fan, if you're okay with playing online, it's an excellent way to start figuring out what cards you care about and what cards you don't, so that when you go to eBay or wherever, you have a sense for what you want.
So what about folks that just have never had occasion to play online card games like that? Would you suggest Lackey or would you suggest Tabletop?
I would suggest you try both. I would start with Lackey. It's a lighter interface. It is simpler to understand how to use, and it has a deck editing experience. It's not pretty. It's never going to be pretty.
That's okay. But the one thing,
it's a good place to start.
One thing you did not mention is that once you get on either one of these programs, I think it's more lackey though than tabletop, is that you can now see every single card that was made. And so you can make decisions for yourself having or being able to look at all the different cards. For example, there are still, I think there's still two or three physical cards that I have never actually seen. I'm familiar with them. I know what they say. I know what they look like, but I've never actually seen the actual card. And I've been at this for over 20 years. So being able to go online to this thing, if, even if you don't use it to play with, just the ability to see all of the entire cards is worth the price of admission alone.
So what are these mysterious cards you haven't seen, Chester?
You know, I don't know them until I see them.
Okay.
There's literally not that many of them that I haven't seen. There are a number of, there's two dozen cards that I've never actually owned. Night Gear D, for example, I've never owned one. I've only ever seen one. You know, so that's a problem with all CCGs is the rarity factor.
I think you're just trying to give a testament to the unseen factor in BattleTech is, you know, with your
That's a whole nother.
Yeah, we're not going to go there.
History thing. Right.
Michael, for those tip-top simulator plugins, how do people know which one is, you know?
Go to Facebook, go to the announcements on the group. Yeah. It will take you to the specific one.
Gotcha.
Don't run a search on tabletops on Steam. Don't search on Steam. You'll find five or six different ones.
Okay.
Go to Facebook group.
Now, what's the community like there? How many people, you know, are usually playing? Is it easy to find a game? Do you have to try to coordinate with people beforehand to make sure you're on there?
Well, it's we're not a big community, right? We haven't been a big community for 20 years. I recommend coordinating offline with people. Mm-hmm. And there are at least four or five people that I know play on Tabletop Simulator regularly and probably about the same on Lackey. I haven't played a game of BattleTech in many months, right? I've been stuck at home with small children who aren't going to school. So, you know, my time to actually play the game, especially lately, has been limited.
Right.
And even before then, I'd been spending a lot of time on the local group. We've actually been able to have in the Bay Area real physical meetups. I think we've done three so far. We did them in 3-month intervals. The first one had about 8 people. The second one had about 4 people. And the third one had something like 9 or 8 or 9 people. And if you can, I mean, there's nothing more fun than physically getting together and slinging cards, right?
Yeah.
So that's been my focus lately.
Well, let's use that to pull that back into the you know, physical cards. Cause I know, you know, as I said at the beginning, you know, I got into this cause I wanted to play a game with my girlfriend and I wanted, can I be in BattleTech? And certainly she wasn't, we're going to sit on our computers playing against each other. And so for those cards, you know, one, I want to kind of go back a little, you know, you said there are about a quarter of the available 850 or so cards that were unplayable.
Yep.
You know, one, I'm sure any new player coming in would want to know what those cards are. Is there a list? Is there an Excel sheet? Is that something you guys can produce to say these are the cards, don't bother with these cards?
Well, yes and no. I mean, first of all, hobbyists being what they are, there's never going to be a controversy-free version of this list.
Okay.
Right? Even between me and Chester, we cannot agree that you know.
Oh, I think we agree. I think we could agree at least on 150 cards, guaranteed. We would agree.
Sure.
This is useless.
Now, even if you did, mm-hmm. I mean, there's really two ways. There's three ways to buy cards, I think, right? The first way is to buy in bulk. To say, I'm just going to get a bunch of stuff. I don't know what's in it, and I'm going to figure out what I can do with it, mm-hmm. right? And that is mostly where I got started. I think I did the math, and in the last 10 years, I have spent about $3,500 on BattleTech cards, and I have sold about $4,000 worth of BattleTech cards. So I've ended up breaking even. But that's not to say it didn't take a lot of effort to make all this sort of thing work.
Right.
So buying in bulk is a great way to start, just to have some idea. And especially because the price, we'll talk about the prices later, I think, but they're interesting.
Well, I think, to touch on what you pulled, because I do the same thing. I basically tell myself I have to keep my hobby budget at zero. So I buy in bulk, sell off, a little bit to pay for what I bought and go. But I think, if you're doing it that way, what you probably didn't mention is that, you come out a couple hundred bucks ahead, but more than that, you have a complete collection of cards that are still in your hands, right? That
it takes work.
That you haven't sold, but you have your collection plus you kind of cover expenses. Yeah. But, so buying in bulk from people that, selling out and certainly, periodically on the Facebook group, you find people that, come in and say that they found this old collection. They're trying to get rid of it.
Now there's a couple of people out there who are sitting on very large quantities of bulk cards that when the stars are right, you can get bulk cards from them at a reasonable price. Let me do a little shout out to Jared Shorter, Striker JB on eBay. Now Jared has a very large amount of cards and his basic problem is logistical. Like he doesn't have good physical access to them. So at some point, hopefully in the future, he will, and he will be quite happy to sell off bulk cards. But he moves around. Jared, Jared is someone I've done many trades with in the past. He's incredibly trustworthy. He's a good person to trade or sell rares with. There are a few folks like that.
Someone come in and, they have, let's say they have a couple starters and a couple boosters.
Right.
Let's talk about kind of the bare bones, first couple games, because these are the questions I asked in the Facebook group was great for it, but we can kind of cover it here,
Sure.
What's the deck composition? Let's kind of go over that first.
All right. So first couple of games, you want to completely ignore any faction stuff. Right? You don't want to be thinking about Davian versus Karita versus Clan Jade Falcon. You don't want to think about it. Just a 60-card deck. And there's a standard breakdown for 24 units, mechs or vehicles or battle armor or whatever, 24 resources, 12 other cards, right? And the other cards is where you add some theme. Like you might say, there's particular pilots that I like, or, I want to use mercenary contracts, which don't work very well, but I want to add some flavor to the deck. Let's see. I wrote up a basic deck design tactics article in the Facebook group, so we'll add that to the show notes. So the first thing you want to think about is your asset mix. So there are five assets: assembly, logistics, munitions, politics, and tactics. So of those, some are better than others. Simple fact, right? The three best assets are assembly, logistics, and tactics. Munitions has always been the red-headed stepchild, as it were. Munitions, the problem with munitions is that munitions only does, okay, so how do I think about it? So there's three things that an asset can do for you. The first thing is that an asset has a benefit in and of itself, right? The second thing is that an asset allows you to pay the buyouts for your mechs, and so it allows you to have mech choices that you like. And the third thing that an asset does for you is it allows you to play cards that other cards that require those assets. So if you analyze each of the assets, let's think about, for example, assembly. Assembly's benefit is allows you to repair your cards. It allows you to pay the buyout costs for a lot of mechs. Many, many mechs have an assembly cost. And the third thing, like enabling additional non-unit cards, assembly doesn't do much for you there. But nevertheless, so many mechs have assembly buyouts and you never, ever want to be in a position where you have to pay the buyout. So assembly is important for the simple reason that there are so many, almost all of the best mechs in the game require assembly buyouts, and you never want to be in a position to pay a buyout. Mm-hmm. So without assembly, your mech choices shrink drastically. Okay, so that's one. Logistics has the ability to restock a card is not generally useful. Logistics also doesn't apply to many mech buyouts, although it does help you with vehicle buyouts. What logistics does is it gives you access to a wide range of other cards that can, like command cards that can be very useful. So as I said before, most command cards are bad. Most command cards that are good need logistics, including a lot of the best stalemate breakers. Logistics is probably the one asset that I would avoid as a beginner, but seriously dive into as an advanced or intermediate player. Understanding how to make the most of logistics is really important for intermediate and advanced play. Munitions only benefit is for missile decks. And there's sort of a core problem with the way missiles are designed in Battletech. Missile decks aren't very good. They're like a trap for a beginner. Like a beginner sees, oh, I could build a theme out of this. And the truth is you can, but it generally has a pretty low ceiling of effectiveness. And if you don't have missiles, you don't want to be playing mechs that are like some missiles and some attack, because the randomness of missiles tends to cause you problems. You typically want to play either a deck that goes massively out on missiles or a deck that doesn't use missiles at all. And if I can segue for a little bit, this is one of the problems in the design space of Battletech that the designers never really understood, because in the Battletech board game, there are many, many mechs that mix. So in Battletech CCG, missile means LRMs, right? Long range missiles. There are many mechs in the Battletech board game that mix LRMs with direct fire weapons. Many of the most efficient mechs and the most loved mechs in the Battletech board game mix LRMs and long range weapons. But it doesn't work in the CCG. It just isn't effective. You're paying for missiles and they're not useful. So if you're not using missiles, what does munitions give you? The only thing it gives you is the ability to pay the buyout of mechs that require a munitions buyout. And most advanced players will say, I'm just not going to use mechs that require a munitions buyout. I'm not going to use any munitions at all, and I'm going to restrict myself to either mechs that require assembly and or tactics and or logistics buyouts. Just no munitions. And that is sort of results in, at an intermediate and advanced level, large amounts of cards in the board game just don't see play. Just large amounts of mechs don't see play at intermediate and advanced levels, because nobody wants to be playing munitions just because they want to pay munitions buyouts on mechs. The ALT buyout mechs are good enough, and you don't do it. So that's munitions. Next up is politics. As a beginner, steer clear of politics. Politics is the dirty tricks asset. Most of the weird and interesting effects in the game require politics buyouts. One mech, I think, requires a politics buyout. But basically, politics never helps you for units. It only ever helps you for dirty tricks. And if you're still trying to master the basic effects in the game, then dirty tricks are not the right place to start. Right. So forget politics. And that brings you to tactics. Tactics is the one asset that you should never go without. The tactics ability to give you one point of initiative as a base is incredibly important. Because winning initiative in battles is a very valuable thing. You've got mechs with overheat, you've got mechs with alpha strike, you've got mechs with jump. You want to win initiative. The other thing that tactics gives you is the ability to get around the deployment limit. So in Battletech, you draw two and then you get two deployments every turn, right? Which means your hand size stays roughly constant throughout the game, which means that at the end of the game, you're still sitting there with five cards in your hand. What if those cards are on the table, right? How can you make those cards get down on the table? And the answer is you have three ways. You can either play cards that generate more deployments. You'll draw two and you'll play three every turn. That's generally not very effective. The second option is you can use units that are, or cards that are free deployments themselves. That tends to work. And the third thing you could do is you can play missions. Mission cards bypass the deployment limitation. If I'm in a situation where I get into a fight and a mission card means that one of my mechs lives when it would have died, I have just traded a mission card that requires no resources and no deployments for a mech that I would otherwise have had to build a new one, right? So trading your mission cards for the lives of your mechs or for the kills of other people's mechs is an incredible way to get around the resource limitations that BattleTech sets up. And if you want to play missions, you need initiative. And if you want initiative, you pretty much need tactics. And so to recap the five assets, you always want to be playing tactics. You almost always want to be playing assembly. And you sometimes want to be playing logistics or munitions in a combat deck, as opposed to a dirty tricks deck. I would say that a good starting mix is AMT, where you just lump having the M because the selection of mix that you have is relatively weak because you just have the cards that you have. If you're a player with six of every card, you'd almost never use M in a combat deck because you'd simply have six of the relevant mix that don't require M that are still very good. A classic example of this is the Thor M in Clan Jade Falcon. It's a 2-6-6 moderate with an ALT buyout. It's fantastic because ALT are the assets that you tend to play in an advanced deck that doesn't have a lot of dirty tricks in it, right? An advanced combat deck is typically an ALT deck. So it's a great card. It's a rare from Arsenal. You probably don't have it if you're a beginner. And even if you did have it, you might have one. Of course, on the computer, you have everything, so that's a different story. But if you're physically slinging cards, you just got to live with what you have, and you end up playing M because you have the mix you have. So I would say, as a beginner, start with an AMT deck. 24 mix. So to get back to the point, 24 mix, 4-6 missions, 6 to 8 command cards, whatever you find interesting, 24 resources in assembly, munitions, and tactics.
Now, for looking at those mechs, assuming you have more than 60 cards, you know, what are kind of general rules of thumb for this is a good mech, this is a bad mech for those new players?
Okay. Well, the first thing you should do is that you should avoid any mech with a large alpha strike, where the alpha strike is large, but also, the attack is relatively large. A classic example of this is the Hunchback 2C, which has something like an attack of 5 and an alpha strike of 5, or something like that. Alpha strike was incorrectly designed in the base game, and alpha strike costs too much, which is unfortunate. A very good mech with alpha strike is the Centurion 1-6-2 alpha strike plus 2. For 2+2A. Excellent mech. Or the Saladin, a hovercraft with 1 attack and 2 alpha strike. But most big alpha strike mechs are not worth your time. This is why a lot of the most charismatic mechs, like the Daishi Prime, not the Daishi Prime, like the Kodiak, for example, with its large alpha strikes, not very efficient. The second thing you should avoid is large overheats. Small overheats are a good place to play around as you're learning the tactics, because a lot of it in CCG once you get into a battle is who's got initiative, who's winning the initiative, who's losing the initiative. If I do this overheat, will he point his damage at this mech? But if I can, if I can win initiative, I can overheat without hurting myself. Like, high overheats make your life difficult. So stick with low overheats and low alpha strikes. The next thing that you should do is understand that any unit which has an attack of 1 or less is not usually, and I know Chester will point out that there are some times that there is, but it's not usually worth your time. You tend to want to have units with a 2 attack or higher. That's a third pointer. Let's see. Fourth pointer. Think about your cost curve. Your cost curve should start around 1 or 2, peak at around 4 or 5 and taper off towards 7 or 8. Having a few mechs that cost 10 or 11 or 12 is good for breaking stalemates. And we should talk about stalemates later. But generally speaking, you'll be doing most of your fighting with mechs that cost 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 resources.
You need to have fast mechs in your deck.
Right. You should have at least 6 fast mechs in your deck, ideally ones that have a reasonable amount of structure and armor. A good example of this is the Fenris Prime. 3+, it's a common from limited. 3+1A+1M+1T for a 1/6/3 fast mech. What's happening there is that mech, remember that mechs can attack slower mechs. So if I have 3 fast mechs down on the table, and you have 3 moderate mechs down on the table, I can send my fast mechs to individually beat up your moderate mechs, and you can't block because you can only block with a unit that is equal to or faster than the attacking group. Having a fast mech screen is very important so that you can play defense against a deck with a lot of fast mechs. Right.
So, and I had one question I want to pull back, but I didn't want to interrupt you at the time. You were talking about the overheat, you know, avoiding high overheat and high alpha strike. You know, is there a ratio? You know, so is it, you know, 2 overheat for 1 attack? You know, ignore that because it's not worth it. 2 for 2, like, is there? Okay. You know.
So generally speaking, if the overheat cost is higher than the attack bonus, you're rarely going to use the overheat.
Okay.
And if the overheat cost is lower than the attack bonus, you're almost always going to use the overheat. Mm. Unless it's something weird like overheat 4+5, in which case you have a serious chance of destroying yourself with your overheat if you're not careful. But like a overheat 1+2 is vastly more valuable than an overheat 2+1.
Gotcha. And the relationship of overheat value to your armor, you know, is that
right.
worth considering
if,
as
yes.
well?
Yes. If your overheat value is such that... Okay, so let's back up. When you're in a battle, which is more than like a one-on-one, the good tactic is to concentrate fire. So in BattleTech the board game, if I may segue, in BattleTech the board game, there's this remarkable effect that as you beat up your opponent's mech, they sort of lose limbs and weapons, and they generally become less effective at hurting you the more damage they've taken.
Right.
In BattleTech the card game, this is not true. And it's really important. A mech like a Masakari, which is a 3/10/8 that has 9 structure damage on it, it's limping along and requires 1 more structure damage to kill, is going to do just as much damage in a fight as one that is pristine. The result of this fact is that you either want to be destroying mechs or you want to be leaving them alone, which means you want to concentrate fire. And when you're thinking about who you're going to attack with and who you're going to block with, you really want to be thinking about kills, not damage, kills.
And it's so, a difference in perspective.
Right. And so when you're dealing with, for example, playing mission cards, a mission card that will save your mech from destruction, even if it only leaves you with 2 structure points on a 10 structure mech, is still worth a lot, because it gives him another opportunity to deal his full attack again, right? So having set this up, now you want to think about, I'm in a battle with you, and I've got a mech that has an overheat. If I can make you choose your actions first, if I can make you lose initiative, you now have to decide if you're going to hit the mech with the overheat or not. Let's say you could kill one or the other, but not both. If you choose to kill the mech with the overheat, then it's a no-brainer. I'm going to overheat. I'm already dead, right? If you choose to kill the mech without the overheat, and the overheat on the mech that I do have with the overheat is relatively small, it's not going to hurt it much. Like it's a 2-point overheat on a mech with 2 armor, or a 2-point overheat on a mech with 1 armor with 6 structure, right? It's not going to do a lot of damage to survivability. It's also a no-brainer, and I'm going to use it.
Let me toss in there on overheat. Overheat is an offensive weapon, all right, because when you attack and you both have the same amount of initiative, tie goes to the attacker. That means whoever loses initiative, and that's usually the defender almost always, you have to assign all your damage to me before I have to assign any damage to you.
You have to make all your decisions before the other side has to make any decisions.
That's right. So you go ahead and put all your stuff, you assign all your damage on my guys. If you don't put any damage on the guy that has the option to overheat, then I'm going to overheat, because normally my armor is going to make that not going to hurt me at all. If you put all your damage on a guy, whether I overheat him or not, he's going to die. I'm absolutely going to use the overheat option. So the timing goes into a lot of whether or not your overheat is going to be effective or not. So that's one thing to keep in mind. That's why the turn structure of a battle is so important. You go through the process of initiative. So who has initiative? Because whoever loses it has to apply all their damage first. They're at a disadvantage.
Right.
So there's two questions that came out of that. One, Chester, kind of caught me because I didn't understand that rule. You said something where the attacker always wins in a tie.
Yes.
And that's not what I understood through the rules. You know, I understood that you roll for it if it's a tie, and then if you tie on the die, you keep rolling. Not it, huh?
Attacker always wins initiative ties.
Okay. All right. And then the second question was going back into that the strategy or the tactics of deciding, you know, where to put your damage on a mech with overheat. You know, where's the balance between saying, well, this mech has an overheat, if I destroy him, then he's definitely going to overheat and do that extra damage, versus maybe I want to leave him with one structure left to disincentivize that overheat. But then it goes back to what you were saying of you want to destroy mechs, you know?
Yes,
so it is,
that's right.
So
if you leave me with a choice that says, if I overheat, I die. And if I don't overheat, I don't die. Then I'm going to ask myself the following question. If I overheat, does that make the difference between me scoring an extra kill or not? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is yes, my overheat will kill my dude, but it will score an extra kill, then it depends. I'm going to have to look at the situation. I'm going to have to look at whether my death is worth the kill, etc. Right? If the answer is no, my overheat won't score an extra kill, I'll just keep my dude alive. Right? And depending on the state of the game, I might end up being able to repair him over time. Or even if not, he'll have one more opportunity to deal his base attack plus his overheat in his next fight where he will inevitably die. Right?
Even if he can't be effective with, you know, all but one damage, all but one structure damage left, I can always put him to guard, okay, and he then becomes a chump blocker.
A chump blocker is a blocker that is not expected to survive the fight and is merely designed to prevent the attacking group from hitting its target.
Right. Yep.
It's a speed bump. Yeah, so yeah, you would never do that. Now, where this becomes relevant with high overheats is in a high overheat situation, you've got a dude. First of all, high overheats are expensive. Like in terms of the resource cost of the mech, they're expensive.
Like there's the Cyclops with it has an overheat 4, but you only get +3 damage.
Right. But overheat you're paying almost huge. It's expensive. So if I'm in a situation where I've won the initiative and you haven't decided to do any damage to my overheating mech, and I now have to think I could overheat with my mech, but it would do a ridiculous amount of damage to my own mech, then I probably won't use the overheat anyway. The place you want to go to see this utter ridiculousness in action is the Black Hawk Prime.
Right.
And the Lokis, the clan mechs that are called Loki, which have absurd overheat and are absurdly expensive, and nobody ever plays them because they're worthless, right? They just don't work. And you know what? In fairness, they don't work in the board game either.
Yeah, that's how they're designed, right?
Yeah, they're what we call fast burners.
Yeah.
Okay, because they get out there and they hit hard and they hit big, but they die quick.
But here's the point. They're not worth the resource cost. I'm not going to pay 10 resources for something like a 177 with an overheat 4+5 moderate, where I can play 10 resources for a 3-10-8 slow who's going to get to deal his 8 damage again and again and again and again. Right. Now, to get to the last piece, which is the Alpha Strike piece, You only ever use Alpha Strike for two reasons. One, if you lost initiative and your mech's going to die. If you know your mech is going to die, you should Alpha Strike for sure. And the other reason is to score a kill, depending on the quality of the kill. Because what happens when you use Alpha Strike is you forego a whole turn's worth of use out of that mech, which means you forego all of the damage, the base attack damage that that mech has. So let's consider, for example, a hypothetical where you've got a mech with an attack of 8 and an Alpha Strike of 2. Getting that extra 2 points of damage means you're giving up on 8. That's a lot to give up on. It better be worth it. It better be the difference between winning the game or killing an incredibly high value target, or you're at least in a situation where you're at such a stalemate that you don't have any problem waiting out a turn. But giving up a base attack of 8 next turn to do 2 more damage now, it's not good. And Wizards of the Coast didn't understand that, and they priced Alpha Strike at something like Alpha Strike value divided by 2, which means that an Alpha Strike plus 4 on a mech with attack 10 costs 2 resources, and you'd never use it. And an Alpha Strike of plus 4 on a mech with 1 attack costs also 2 resources, and you'd always use it, right? This is why the Saladin is good, because the Saladin has an attack, it costs almost nothing. It's got an attack of 1 and an Alpha Strike of 2. Which means it's net better to Alpha Strike at every round.
I'm talking, about getting a couple players, and we talked a little bit before about kind of bringing those optimized decks versus kind of bringing that mixture of decks. What are some kind of deck building? Let's say you're playing with two people that definitely are interested in kind of winning. They're competitive, but they also want to have fun in that. What are kind of either cards or strategies to avoid that are going to create a negative play experience for newer cards, and or on the other side, what's going to maximize a good play, a positive play experience?
All right. So let's talk about the negative play experience, because Chester is the expert on positivity.
Okay.
And I'm the expert on negativity.
All right. Well, we'll split that up.
So the first thing is, obey the DCI banned list. Nobody wants to see elite mech warriors. Nobody wants to see disguised coordinates. Nobody wants to see
Dasher D, I think.
Dasher D actually was never the issue. Funnily enough. Nobody wants to see effective groundworks.
Right.
So that's the first thing. The second thing, there are a small selection of cards that generate sort of pathological behaviors. Let me see if I can list out those for you now, just very quickly. Okay, so here they go. The Blitzkrieg elemental point is the most powerful elemental point, and it's good. It's not going to break a game, but it's very good. So be aware that if someone's bringing 6 Blitzkriegs, they're not playing to lose. Secondly, Solaris Contacts can cause problems. Solaris Contacts is a way of playing pilots without paying their resource costs or their deployment costs. A deck which uses the Star League to gain access to a large number of unique, extremely expensive pilots like Kai Champion of Solaris or Victor Steiner Davian or Aris Sung, and then plays them for free with Solaris Contacts is not a good time. Avoid any deck that uses the card Sandhurst Royal Military Academy, especially if it's a swarm deck. That is another spike in the meta that nobody has fun with. And
except the person playing it.
Sorry?
Except the person playing it.
only if their purpose is to never play with the other player again. Avoid decks that reuse Task Force Serpent over and over. That's a unique card from Crusade that allows you to pull a whole bunch of cards from your deck. It should have said remove from the game when played. It says scrap when played, so that you can pull it out of your scrap heap and play it again and again and again and again. So don't use decks that regenerate Task Force Serpent. And finally, I would say be careful about the card Merchant Cast, which is a clan card that, like Solaris Contacts, allows you to play resources without paying their resource cost or their deployment cost, especially when combined with the card Improved Construction Facilities, which is a Crusade common, costs 4, tap for 3 resources. It's fine if you have to pay the resource cost, but if you get to play it for free with Merchant Cast, it's a problem. So let me go back over them. Blitzkrieg Elemental Point, not going to break your game, but is notably better than all the others. Solaris Contacts, when combined with Star League and a large number of unique pilots. Sandhurst Royal Military Academy, which is a Comstar card combined with anything. Decks that regenerate Task Force Serpent and use it over and over again. And decks that abuse Merchant Cast for the same reason as Solaris Contacts. Those are the specific key points in the meta that I would avoid.
Now, are there, if people are coming and they're playing with house rules, are there suggested errata for various cards that you would add? You know, you mentioned for the one card that you said remove it from the game.
Yes, we do have a set of suggested errata for each of those cards, which I'll be happy to put in the show notes.
Okay.
Now, as far as basic standard gameplay, you're familiar with, you played Magic before yourself, right?
Briefly, long time ago.
Briefly, long time ago.
Yeah, we're talking, 20 years ago.
That's okay. You're familiar with playing a deck and just not getting any resource cards, no land cards at all. What right. happens? You die horribly. You lose, it's incredibly frustrating.
Nobody has any fun. I think this is
nobody
actually,
has
if, I can, if I can interrupt, this is an argument that a lot of people have about whether getting land screwed is part of the game or not. The strongest argument that I've seen on this one, the one that I ascribe to, is this. This is not a competitive game. This is a fun game. It's a heritage game. People are here to have fun. If you play a 30-minute game and the game was decided by your lack of resources that occurred during the shuffling stage of the game, and everything else is just playing out the inevitable that you didn't know, nobody is having fun. You're not having fun when you lose because of this. And a key point, the player who wins the game probably isn't having fun either. Right? And so, please continue, Chester.
So about 5 years after, in about 2000, somewhere around 2005, I decided to put together a set of rules. I call it dual stockpile. And so what you do is you have a small deck that has nothing but resources in it. And nobody can touch it except you. You get to draw cards from it. And then all of your other cards go into your operational deck. So you have two separate decks. The idea is that you can draw from either one that you choose in any order that you choose. You can look at one before you draw the other, okay? This prevents resource screw completely. It doesn't prevent asset screw. In other words, if you need A or T or M, you know, you might wind up finding all those on the bottom, but you will always find basic resources.
We'll put a link in the show notes to the specific rules governing how dual stockpile rules work.
Yeah, there used to be a lot more involved because it took me a while to process after the game was gone that it was never going to come back. There was no hope. And what to do with the 850 cards that were available? Well, there's all these cards that are that he described for Task Force Serpent, these really high expensive cards that are exceptionally cool to play with. But in a 60-deck format where you can't always count on getting those resources out, you never play with them, period. And so what I did was I structured a way for you to be, I started out as a 50 and 20, so 20 resources and 50 operational cards. And I said, okay, in the 50 cards, you have to use at least 2 uniques. And there was a couple of other things that you had. And so what this did was it caused you to use more of the 850 cards that were available, more of them became viable, okay, because you're always able to get resources when you want to. It wasn't until later, and this went pretty well. Back in the days, very quickly after Battletech died, there was a Yahoo group on there, And we talked about all this kind of stuff. And I got onto this DSR kick, and there was a number of places around the, the country where it's still played today. But when I got with Michael, we said, well, let's tweak this just a little bit. Instead of 20 and 50, let's do 24 and 48. And what that does is, in any, if you run across somebody that's not familiar with the dual stockpile rules, if you just simply take out any 12 cards out of your operational deck, you put them together with the 24, bam, you're right back at 60 cards and you got a standard deck. You never have to shuffle between one and the other. Wow, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought about it. And so that's what we've got for dual stockpile. But it's a format that over the years has just proved itself over and over. It's just, it's a great way to play. It's very difficult for you to get slammed out, you know, in the first few turns. It can still happen, you know, but it's just it's a more fun way to play. And now with the whole idea that, you know, I just take out 12 cards, boom, I'm right back to the standard. You know, it's the ease of play of deck building actually remains.
So what's the win condition there? Is that people just have to deplete your operational pile, or
that's right.
Exactly it. You can't go after their resource stockpile. Okay. But you know, and so there are some odd little things, like, so if you get down, you've only got like 3 cards left in your operational pile, you're not drawing those anymore.
Right.
You're drawing strictly from the other, but you're going to run out of those too, and that usually means that you're in some kind of a weird stalemate.
And when you're feeding, if you have logistics, you know, are you able to just feed resources back into the upper?
Yes, you can. It's one of the little corners. There's a lot of things in DSR that look like they should make a difference, but don't. So one example is this whole idea of preserving life by not drawing operational cards and only drawing resource cards when you're down to 3. People say, well, how? Well, that changes the game. It actually doesn't, because any player who's on the back foot and is only drawing resources, still going to lose, right?
Yeah.
And the other one is, it does change the size of the stockpile from 60 to 72, but typically you don't draw your entire resource deck anyway. So typically at the end of the game, you still have maybe about 12 cards in your resource stockpile. So the length of the game is actually about the same as well. Mm-hmm. It works remarkably well. Although I will mention that there are some strategies that don't work anymore. Most notably, any decks that are built around resource destruction simply don't work in DSR. And there's two kinds of decks of those. One is like resource hunter decks, like Jade Falcon Elementals, where they can do 7 damage to resources. And then you won't draw any more resources because it's a regular 60 card deck, and then you lose. That doesn't work anymore. And the other one is like strategic bombardment decks that are designed to bomb out your resources. They don't work anymore either. But it's a small price to pay. Actually, one additional point I wanted to add to the deck design thing that I just remembered that's important. BattleTech has a magic number, and that magic number is 7. And that is the amount of damage that you want to be doing, because 7 damage is enough to destroy a resource. 7 damage is enough to destroy most command cards. 7 damage is, there's a lot of mechs that are like 1-6 or 2-5, and a lot of the best mechs are 1-6 or 2-5, the Fenris, the Centurion. So the sweet spot for attack is 3s and 4s,
okay,
right? You go too far below that. 2 is acceptable on fast mechs, but it's not really good for line mechs. 1 is not acceptable. And once you get to 5s, 6s, and 7s, you're starting to talk about your more expensive mechs that come out less often. But generally speaking, try to make sure that your combat combinations, which is like you take a look at all the mechs in your deck, and you're like, you put them together in different combinations. Like this guy might be going on a mission with this guy, and you try to make 7 as much as you can. It's a neat little extra trick there.
Now, going back to the basic topics, in terms of, what do you guys suggest in terms of target priority? You know, when is it the right decision to target mechs versus stockpiles versus resources versus command cards?
Okay, I'll take this one. So if you're targeting resources, you should only be targeting resources in one of three situations. The first is if your deck is really built around denying your opponent resources and you're not playing dual stockpile rules, right? And then you're actually trying to run them out of resources. The second is if they have, let's say they've got 6 or 7 resources out, but they've only got 1 assembly and all the rest are tactics, right? They're playing an AT deck and they've got 5 tactics out and 1 assembly. Well, if you take out that 1 assembly, obviously if they had more assemblies, they would have played them instead of playing the tactics, right? But if you take it out, now they're having to pay assembly buyouts again, right? So that's the second reason. And the third reason is if you're dealing with resources that do superpower stuff, like, for example, improved construction facilities, right? It's a single card that taps for 3 resources. Those are targets. So that's when you attack resources. Now, attacking command cards, you've got, okay, so you want to think of, when you attack, you want to think about this, right? If you can attack and get through, and the target is worth killing, and the retaliation is something that you can manage, because remember, if you tap all your mechs, they're not available to block, and the opponent is going to untap all their mechs, and then they're going to come for you, right? If that you can destroy the target, and you can handle whatever retaliation is going to come due to the fact that you're going to have some tapped mechs on the field, and the target is worthwhile, you should destroy it. Like, for example, if somebody plays Melissa Steiner Davian, you should destroy Melissa Steiner Davian, right? 2/2 tap, scrap a card from your hand to take any card from your scrap heap and put it in your hand. She can turn any card in her hand into any card in the scrap heap. You think you destroyed that thing? You think you put in a lot of effort to blow it up? He can pull it back and play it again. Melissa Steiner Davian must die, right? And it's worth putting effort into a target that valuable. On the other hand, if the person played like a training facility, which gives all of his pilots +1/+1, right? What's more valuable, 6 damage on a training facility or 6 damage on the deck, right? It's probably 6 damage on the deck. So that's the second consideration, like the target's value. The third consideration is the extent to which you're trying to generate fights. Now, one of the best things to do on the tabletop in the CCG is set up situations where your opponent is making bad trades, right? Where your opponent loses 2 mechs and you lose 1. Or when your opponent loses a big mech and you lose a small mech. Any time that you can set up a bad trade for them, a good trade for you, you should do it. And this comes up, for example, when you're thinking of attacking mechs. If I have 13 points worth of fast damage that I can put on a Masakari, which is a 3/10/8 slow mech, and nobody's going to block me, that 8 damage that the Masakari is going to do is probably going to kill one of my guys. Like, let's say I've got 4 Fenris Primes with a little pilot to get the 13 damage, whatever. I'm going to lose a Fenris Prime that costs 3. And he's going to lose a Masakari, which costs 10. That's an unfair trade. If I can make that trade happen, I should do it. If I'm winning, if I've got 5 mechs out and you've got 3 mechs out, I'm even cool with even trades, right? Because at the end of the day, I'll have 2 mechs left standing. And so you want to think about what's happening on the table. To what extent will your choices and attackers generate a response in your opponent that is going to be what you want it to be, right? To generate those uneven trades. Because Battletech is prone to a problem of stalemating. And the problem of stalemating is really important, and I want all the viewers to understand what that problem is. Let's imagine that we're in a situation where I play a mech and you play a mech, and I play a mech and you play a mech, and I play a mech and you play a mech, and the table grows, right? I've got 4, then 5, then 6, and you've got 4, then 5, then 6, and we look relatively evenly matched. Attacking is a disadvantage. Why? Because I have to show you what I'm attacking with before you decide what you're blocking with. And so I've got a situation where if I attack with one guy, you might decide to block with 2 guys and create an unfair trade. If I attack with all of my guys, you might decide to block with 1 guy, and then all of my dudes are tapped. Next turn, all of your dudes untap and you attack me. There is sort of a fundamental problem with it being disadvantageous to attack And the more mechs appear on the table, the more that situation happens. You can think of it like the First World War. You settle into trenches. A lot of the best decks in Battletech CCG are designed around never getting to that point. They're designed to put enough tempo pressure on your opponent that they can never get off the back foot. A lot of fast decks, and by which I don't mean decks that have fast mechs, but I mean decks that play fast, are designed to avoid like hell a settling into a stalemate. And this is especially true of swarm decks. If you can settle a swarm into a stalemate, you're going to win. Why? Because you've got 6 resources on the table and they've got 3 resources on the table. And every turn you're drawing 6 or 8 resources worth of mechs into your hand. And every turn they're drawing 2 resources worth of mechs into their hand because they run out of steam, right? If you can get a swarm deck into a stalemate, you're going to win. So they want to keep it fluid. But if the stalemate starts to set in, you have a problem. Both players have a problem. And that actually kind of becomes a little less fun. And so what you want to have in your deck is you want to have cards that break stalemates. I'll give a few examples. Inside Job breaks a stalemate. Or Inside Job Unopposed, for example, breaks a stalemate. Because if you can do 12 damage to your opponent, for example, and maintain a stalemate, they're going to lose because now your deck is here, their deck is here, and they lose, right? Double time offense from Counter-Strike, one of the few good Counter-Strike cards, breaks stalemates by allowing you to untap mechs. So you do something like, I've got 8 counters on double time offense, and my opponent thinks, oh, he's just building a large mech. Now I attack with everything, not at the same time, but in a system designed to force my opponent to use all his mechs to block, like one and then another, whatever. The point being that my opponent is willing to do all of his blocking because he knows he's about to untap and crush me. So now I'm in a situation where all of my mechs are tapped, all of your mechs are tapped. I reveal double time offense. I untap my 2 biggest mechs. And then I come in for the kill, right? Breaking the stalemate. Other cards that break stalemate include Treachery or anything that allows you to whittle away your opponent without being forced into bad trades. For example, mech hunting. If I've got sufficient mechs that you can't really attack me effectively, but my fast mechs have free reign to start picking your dudes off, I'm going to break the stalemate over time.
Right.
You asked a question about what is the best way for new players to learn the system, mm-hmm. And to get the fundamentals of deck building down. There is nothing faster for accelerating that process than playing the game. Whatever deck that you've got, play it at least 2 or 3 times every sitting, because every time you play it, you're going to learn something either about the rules or about what the capabilities are of the cards that you're playing. So especially if you've got 2 guys that, you know, haven't played for 20 years, or 2 guys that only played, you know, have never played the game before, you sit down, you both have a deck, pilot the deck 3 times in a row, okay? You will learn so much. If you have time, then switch the decks, okay? And do it that way. But once you've got, you know, just playing one deck one time, okay, and you and an hour goes by, and you go, okay, well, let's go try something. No, you need to play it as many times as you can, and that will help your deck building and your game understanding faster than anything that we can tell you here.
Right, and you'll come across learnings like, well, I played that card, that command card for 3, but actually I would have rather had this mech, or, well, I played this mech, and they cost about the same, but I got this one did a lot better. I wonder why that is. And to add a third thing, so you, deck building, you said the capabilities of your cards, but here's the third thing. Battletech CCG has a much larger decision space at the time of gameplay than Magic. Magic, you spend a lot more time designing your deck, and then once you design your deck, like the decision space on the table is more limited because the choices that you have are fewer. Battletech, because of the tap to attack, tap to block, infinite sequential mission setup, has got a very wide space of activity, like a decision space during the missions phase. Learning the contours of that decision space, what works and what doesn't, is going to be vital for a beginner. Learning, for example, that if I did end up doing a large attack and he chump blocked and then he turned around and attacked me with all his dudes, it doesn't work. So I should watch out for chump blockers next time. Or learning that even though I was able to create a situation where I made all his blocking mechs tap and then my last mech got in for 4 points of damage, right? That's still not worth it because he untaps with all his dudes, I have nothing, and he comes in for 20 points of damage, right? Learning how that interaction happens on the battlefield is the third vital thing.
And now when, for that target selection, when is it helpful to target mechs in under construction and make that decision? Is that a viable?
It's never viable to attack mechs under construction unless you're very early in the game. Okay. The classic move is, I play first, I play down an assembly. You play second, you play a resource, you tap it, you put a card under construction. I play next, I play another resource, tap those two resources, play a dasher, and then I have a choice between laying 3 points of damage on your deck or destroying your card under construction. I should destroy your card under construction. Because at that early stage, the card that's there is worth more than the few points. Like, those 3 points of damage are only going to be meaningful at the end of the game, but destroying that card under construction is meaningful right now, right? That's just about the only circumstance. And by the way, this happens a lot. People get very upset about it. If you know your opponent is playing dashers and you know that they went first and you go second, think twice before you play a resource, tap it, and put, you might just play two resources down instead. But apart from that sort of situation, because remember, construction counters are actually really tough. It's right. Two attack per construction counter, and then one more attack to destroy the card. Mm-hmm. So if the thing has got one resource on it, it's probably worth doing. If the thing's got two or more, it's not. Unless you think whatever the card that person is building is a scrap win revealed command card. If you don't think it's a unit. So for example, let's say there's a 10-point card down on the table being constructed, and you don't know if it's a Daishi or a double time offense. And you're more afraid of the double time offense than you are of the Daishi, which you should be. Sending something to plink 1 point of damage into it, or even 0 points of damage, as long as you're unblocked, the card is revealed. When the card is revealed, if it says scrap when revealed, it is scrapped with no effect.
Right.
And that can be particularly useful. There are decks that like to basically defend themselves while they build 40 point. The card is called Corridor of Fire. It's effectively like a Magic's Fireball. So they're building 40 resources on top of a Corridor of Fire. But if you sneak one guy in there and reveal that card, it will scrap with no effect. And that is what those decks are afraid of. They have to prevent you from hitting it even one time.
And then how vigorously do you want to defend your stockpile? Is it, defend damage at all cost? When is keeping a mech alive more important than...
It's not defend damage at all costs. If I could take 5 damage, or I could destroy for free a mech that you have that deals 5 damage without getting hurt, I would destroy the mech. Because that mech could come in and hit my stockpile again and again and again in subsequent turns. Most of the time, tabletop superiority leads to victory, and tabletop weakness leads to defeat. And so if I can drop 10 cards from my stockpile to generate real tabletop, like unchallenged tabletop superiority, I would do it. Unless the game was so close to ending that would make the difference. Like, if I was down to 20 or fewer cards in my stockpile, I would not trade 10 points of damage for tabletop superiority. But above that, I absolutely would, because I can delay my own death sufficiently to beat you down.
Now,
yeah, BattleTech tends to be a lot more forgiving of losing cards off the stockpile. In some ways, it does reflect Magic a little bit that way, in that I'm willing to take a few hits if I know I can come back and, you know, do other things or cause you more problems or more damage that will prevent me from losing life later. So in that, there is a reflective type of strategy there, but it's a close thing. You have to have board awareness. You have to understand, what's he going to come after me with? How much can I afford to take? Sometimes it's worth it to take the extra damage to your stockpile if you can kill something on board that's going to cause you way more problems on down the line. So sometimes you want to gang block and let the smaller guy come on through. You know, it's a situational awareness thing that you learn by playing.
Yep.
The more you play, the better you get. It's that way with any game.
In a typical game of Battletech, you should model yourself as having somewhere between 25 and 35 hit points. Because a typical game of Battletech lasts between 10 and 15 turns. Very fast games can end in 6 or 7, but that's rare. 10 to 15 turns, which means you've drawn 25 to 35 cards, modulo decks that have additional card draw, or decks that like to slide cards underneath, which that isn't much of an effect, but drawing extra cards can be. So you should think about having 25 to 35 hit points. If a magic player would be willing to take 10 damage to generate table supremacy, right? That's not an unreasonable thing to do. And it's much the same in Battletech.
Gotcha. Now going, you know, you had mentioned Melissa Steiner-Davian as kind of a power card, you know, that you definitely want to take out the table. What are just some kind of cards to focus on for each of you guys, or, you know, or even cards to focus on, favorite cards, favorite play, whether they're good or not, just kind of things that, you know, new players can kind of gravitate towards.
Okay. Superior navigation.
Superior navigation is a good fun one.
It's the loveliest card. It's the loveliest card there. The absolute worst thing that can happen is you get to draw another card. You have four out of, it's a two-thirds, right?
Yeah, two-thirds chance to get plus four attack.
Get plus four attack. One-third chance that you not only get the plus four attack, but that you get to untap when you're all done. What's not to love?
Right.
Superior Nav is a great card. I would say, before going into specifics, I would say any mission that allows you to score a kill where one was not expected, or to prevent a kill where one was not expect, where a kill was expected, is a good card. I would have to call out a much maligned but actually incredibly effective card, Good Shooting. It's a limited common. You can find it everywhere. All it says is mech gets plus two attack. That doesn't seem sexy, but let's say I do an attack and you do a block, confident in the knowledge that I can't kill your guy. Well, with Good Shooting, it's quite possible that I can. Other cards of similar nature, Risky Combat Jump, another Counter-Strike card. Forged Mission Orders, Overrun. These are all things that can be used to trade a card in your hand without a deployment for a kill. But the other thing, though, I would caution anyone who's playing missions, don't play too many copies of the same mission, because one of the most important things about a mission is surprise. If you know that if I played one Good Shooting, I caught you by surprise. If I played a second Good Shooting, I might have caught you by surprise. By the time I play my third Good Shooting, you have already adjusted. You know that I have a deck with Good Shootings. You're not going to put yourself in a position where a Good Shooting means the difference between a kill and not a kill. And now the card's value is lost. Missions require a surprise element.
So let's give a little structure there and just kind of have fun. You know, let's go through each expansion, favorite card, each of you guys.
I'll have to defer to Michael, because his knowledge of the game, of the cards, of what each one does is literally encyclopedic.
I've noticed that just in listening here. But for the final stream, I will put graphics of each card that gets mentioned as it gets mentioned, so people can follow along a little bit easier.
Cool. All right. So how about we do it this way? Favorite mech, favorite command, and favorite mission.
All right. And maybe may notable, uncommon, common, so people, you know, more accessible cards, people can be aware of what's viable. Okay.
Like so I should stick to commons and uncommons, you're saying?
No, I'm just saying, just make an extra mention of what in each set, what is a good common uncommon that people can kind of rely on.
So let's start with limited. My favorite mech is without a doubt the Man of War Prime. It's super cheap for its cost. It's super powerful for its cost. It is your linebacker. It can be used by any clan. It's a common, so you should be easy to find. It is a linebacker. It works in every deck. The Man of War Prime.
Agreed.
And that was, if I recall, that's a 5 cost to deploy.
5 cost. 3, 7, 4 moderate speed.
Got it.
My favorite mission. My favorite mission is. Oh, my favorite mission is Studied Move, that's an uncommon. And it can be used by everyone. And to explain why, I'll have to take you on a little detour. A studied move is simply a card that allows you to pull another mission from your scrap heap. If you have tactics in your deck and you have a single jump capable mech, then having a studied move in your hand means that you can play any mission in your scrap heap in any fight. Because you jump to get to 2 initiative, you play studied move, you grab the other mission card, then you immediately play it. It can bring back the same mission card again and again. One of the coolest decks out there is the 3rd place World Championship deck, Barrack Gorge Master, which played something like 8 or 9 missions, singles of each mission, and something like 2 or 3 studied moves. And the intense variety and surprise factor is incredible. Okay, so that's missions. And for command cards... let's see. For command cards, what jumps out? I think I want to say Melissa Steiner Davian. I know she's Steiner only. I know she's unique. She's hard to find. But anytime Melissa hits the table, you have to kill her. She's just so good. She's worth.
Go ahead.
She's worth playing without politics, which makes her cost 4. That's how good she is.
Yep. One nice thing about having cards like that out on the table is that they are must-kill cards, which means all of attention to your stockpile has been diverted. And so you get a couple turns for free with them going after that card and not your stockpile. Which set does improved construction facilities come in?
Crusade. We'll get there.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to Counter-Strike. Counter-Strike mechs, you know, here's the problem. They suck. Counter-Strike's mechs are poor. They're just poor. So I'll go with one that's marginally useful in certain circumstances, the Gladiator D. It's an uncommon, Ghost Bear only, 11 cost, 3, 10, 9. What's so great about it is it has no asset buyouts. So it's incredibly versatile. It's a great stalemate breaker. One of the ways you break stalemates is just by having a few really large mechs. It's a great stalemate breaker. I have a deck that combines Gladiator D with Inside Job unopposed. It's quite a bit of fun.
That's mean.
It is mean. It's got a very high base attack. All right. Missions, you're actually pretty spoiled for choice. Chest has already named Superior Navigation, and I've already named Risky Combat Jump. But for me, they're both intensely good. And the third one that I would go with is Overrun. Overrun is the way you deal with the idea of a chump blocker. You attack with 3 or 4 mechs, and then if they block with a lot of dudes, then you get into a fight, which is probably what you wanted. If they block with one guy, you might use Overrun, and you take no damage, and you've basically traded a mission card for a mech, because Overrun allows all your guys to untap after that fight. Those 3 missions are all great. Superior Nav, Risky Combat Jump, and Overrun. Overrun's common, so it's not hard to find. Now, in terms of commands, The one command that you tend to find in every single deck from Counter-Strike is Black Market Connections, which is a cut rate Melissa Steiner Davian. It's an uncommon, it can be used by everybody, and the only real difference between that and Melissa is that you can have multiple copies in the deck, and it trades two of the cards in your hand for one in your scrap heap, not one, which means it's not sustainable to use long term. But everybody plays it. Chester, do you want to throw in any additional Counter-Strikes while I pull?
I don't know the cards by the by the expansion.
To give you a fighting chance here, Chester, because Michael knows the expansions. Okay. Are there any that pop up? You mentioned one from Crusade that you like. So, irregardless of what set, what are couple favorite cards?
Improved construction facilities. It costs you 4 to get out. Okay, but when you tap it, you get 3 resources. So the cool thing is you have 4 resources on the board. You put that down. You tap all the 4 resources. This comes up. It's now the moment it becomes active, you now have access to 3 resources. So essentially, it costs you 1 to get it out. And then from there on, it's 3 resources every turn. Now, he'll quibble with you on the
math.
Not
quite. The math is slightly different. But I will say it's paid for it at the end of the second turn. And from there on, it's gravy.
Right.
And the nice thing about it is not only is it allowing you to get stuff out, but it is also, it has the most Steiner. You have to kill it. The problem is...
have to, but you probably should.
You probably should. And if you don't, if they don't kill it, if for whatever reason they decide, there's other things I have to do, every turn that it survives is going to punish the other player. It's one of my favorite cards. Yes, absolutely.
Cool. All right. So mercenaries, I want to give a shout out to a card nobody's allowed to play. It's called the Night Sky. It's a card that's so terrifying that it was banned and replaced. You're not allowed to play the Night Sky. Why? Simple. They got the resource formula wrong. It's too cheap. It's like one or two resources too cheap. That's all it is. But that made it so good that you found it. There was a year where I think 4 of the top 8 decks had a full complement of Night Skies.
Hmm.
It was silly. The Night Sky Revised is fine in Commander's Edition. But if we're going to go without the Night Sky, I would say that the Stealth. The Stealth was the first time that the inner Sphere had large, fast mix. And a lot of people enjoyed that. It's an uncommon. It's not a very good one compared to some of the ones that come later, but for the first time, the Inner Sphere had an answer to the Fenris. Cool. So that's units. Missions from Mercenaries. Okay. Missions Unopposed. Unopposed was an attempt basically to make Effective Groundwork work correctly. Effective Groundwork is a banned limited card. Unopposed is simply gives you an attack bonus for your base attack. And when you combine it with Inside Job, you can build a deck around that strategy. It's good fun. And it's also a common. You notice how many cards that I'm naming that aren't rare?
Yeah.
It makes it very accessible. Okay. Command cards. With a shout out for Sandra's Royal Military Academy that you shouldn't use because it's ridiculous. we already talked about that one. I've got to give it to Hidden Reserves. A common, again, anybody can use it. 1+3L, draw 3 cards. If you're playing, so remember that we talked about you have these 5 cards in your hand and you're drawing 2 and you're playing 2. And if at the end of the game, you still have 5 cards in your hand, you're doing it wrong. Some of those 5 cards could have been useful on the table, right? Now, if you use all of them, then you have a different problem. And that problem is that you have to play the 2 cards that you drew every turn because you have no optionality, right? You don't have room to maneuver. But I would argue that you should end the game with 2 or 3 cards in your hand. Now, a typical deck will do this by playing some missions over the course of the game. But what if you want to play a lot of missions? What if you want to play a lot of free deploy cards? Well, you need to draw more cards. Hidden Reserves is the answer. It opens up a lot of strategies. And then that's mercenaries. Mercenaries, by the way, introduced a lot of cards for a mercenary contract. Don't play mercenary contracts. Mercenary contracts don't work. The problem with mercenary contracts being that you have to pay for their upkeep, that you have to play politics, which is painful in a combat deck, and that if you don't win the initiative and use them in exactly the right place, your opponent's going to get the card, right? What is the point of playing a card only to hand it to your opponent?
Because it's fun.
There are ways to make them kind of work, and there's a lot of interesting mercenary contracts in the in mercenaries that have weird and wonderful effects, like bring a mech down from your hand without paying the cost just for one fight, right? It's interesting. You can do interesting things with it.
Yes. One thing about contracts is if you're going to use them, okay, you have to plan your deck around them. You cannot just throw them in for fun, or they will wind up, you know, hurting you or costing you or not having the effects that you want. If you want the weird and wonderful effects that they give, you have to plan your deck around them. Some cards you can just throw in there just for fun because, oh, let me try that or this or that. The mercenary contracts are not like that. You can't just throw them in for fun because there's always a chance that for whatever reason, your opponent may wind up getting you, and then he's got the access for at least one turn for the weird and wonderful.
Right. Okay. Let's move on to the more fun sets. Counter-Strike and Mercenaries are not nearly as interesting. Let's talk about Mech Warrior. Favorite Mech Warrior? I'm going to give it to the Cerberus. The Cerberus is an uncommon. It can be used by anyone in the Inner Sphere. It costs 9 plus 3 L, and it's a 3/7/8.
Yes.
It is one of the first and one of the best Inner Sphere hard-hitting backliners, right? With the attack of 8, that can be used by any faction. And it doesn't have an A cost. So the clans really can't make decks without assembly, but the Inner Sphere can. And so having a hard-hitting heavy mech without an assembly or a munitions cost is extremely versatile. You're always going to want to use the Cerberus.
And what's the speed on that, Michael?
Slow. It's slow.
It's slow. It's okay. Yeah. It can be slow. It's big enough.
Yeah. It's big, it's cheap, it's versatile, and everyone can use it, and it's uncommon. Cool. Missions. Missions in Mech Warrior. They're not that good, but let's say Evasive Maneuvers and its cousin Expert Timing. Now, Evasive Maneuvers is a rare, Expert Timing is an uncommon. There's a fun little Davian deck that's built up around getting huge quantities of initiative, using a crusade pilot called Natural Talent, and then spending it on Evasive Maneuvers and Expert Timing to get benefits.
Oh, yes.
But generally speaking, I would say the Mech Warrior missions aren't very good. And then finally, Commands. Oh, Commands, you are so spoiled for choice. There are so many great cards. There are a wide range of highly playable, unique pilots. And we've already talked about Merchant Cast. We've already talked about Solaris Contacts. We've already talked about what you can do with Solaris Contacts and cards like Kai, Champion of Solaris. So let's avoid all that and go for Corridor of Fire. Corridor of Fire is Corridor of Fire is the first time that you could make the Fireball deck, because there were cards like Saturation Bombing in the limited set, and Saturation Bombing required you to spend two. So these cards are about building up massive counterpiles and turning them into damage, unstoppable damage. Saturation Bombing had a 2-for-1 ratio. Corridor of Fire has a 1-for-1 ratio. I have a ridiculously stupid deck that uses Corridor of Fire along with another Mech Warrior command card called Hidden Location and a unique limited card, Takashi Kurita. It's based around Takashi Kurita prevents opponents from attacking more than once a turn. Attacks against Takashi himself do not count against this limit. So it turns your game into magic again, right? Except that you can chump block five attackers with one. But if Takashi is in a hidden location, you can't hit him either. So you're reduced to one attack per turn, which makes you trivial to defend against while I build up a massive corridor of fire and destroy your stockpile. It's really silly. It's not tournament viable. There are a number of cards that will let you deal with it straight away, but it's just fun. It's one of the very few ways that I've ever seen a classic blue deck, like a lock them down deck, actually work. Okay, so that's Mech Warrior. Let's jump to Arsenal. Arsenal is where things got a little crazy because Arsenal introduced battle armor and vehicles. And battle armor and vehicles, battle armor for the clans and vehicles for the Inner Sphere, both occupy a space in the design space. Do you remember I talked about Battletech's original sin, which is the five free resources you get for every card?
Right.
Vehicles, especially free deploy vehicles, are a way to take massive advantage of this. Free deploy vehicles plus Sandhurst Royal Military Academy, or just free deploy vehicles in general. There are so many good units in this.
Okay, I'll jump in on this one.
Yeah.
Nightshade.
Nightshade's fun.
The Nightshade is a, it costs you, it's zero to get out and one L, I think.
It's one plus two T.
One plus
two. Are you T. thinking about the Serrano?
No. Okay. You're talking about the Cyrano. I'm talking about the Nightshade. Anyway, as I recall it, the Nightshade, when you put it down, okay, it gets you an additional resource. It gets you additional deployment, and it also has what we call the dash ability. It gets to move out into the patrol region after you've already activated it. So here's what it does. It comes out for free. All right.
You're thinking of the Serrano.
Okay, Serrano. Either one. It comes out basically for free. You now still get to make two other deployments, and it hasn't costed you any resources. It also moves out at the same time. So if it's, and it's fast, and it's a VTOL, which means the only thing that can block it is another VTOL.
Or a guarding mech.
If he doesn't have anybody guarding, okay, even if he has fast mech screen out there, you blow right by him. You take one off the top. If you can manage to get a pilot on top of him, okay, it's even worse. If you got one, no, you can't because he's
no pilots for VTOLs.
No pilots for them. But you can. He plays very well with Super Nav, right, and other things. So the reason that getting that extra deployment out, think of it as it's a resource ramp, because now essentially I'm getting three things I get to put down. So if I'm normally putting down two mechs at a time, if I can also use an extra resource to either get three mechs out, which is not all that likely, but if I can at least get out an extra resource later on down the line, every time I get out a free resource for free, okay, it doesn't cost me a deployment, okay, I'm building up my resource base. So that's right. One of my favorite
right.
units.
Right. And so you'll recall that we talked earlier about sort of having to pick something that was good in Counter-Strike and Mercenaries in the unit space and having some trouble with that. Arsenal is completely different. Arsenal, you are spoiled for choice in the units. You have all of those free deploy vehicles. A shout out to the Galleon for being incredible. You have the Saladin. You have the Spectre. Oh, the Spectre, I think, is probably one that you really want to watch out for. It's common. It can be used by anyone in the Inner Sphere. It is the first time that the Inner Sphere have a fast defensive mech that really works. But you can't throw a rock at Arsenal without hitting a unit that is useful. They just did a wonderful job.
Arsenal was fun because they didn't put a limit on
they messed
on,
that
on
up.
How many, and people, as soon as Arsenal came out, people were building, you know, incredibly broken decks of just as many, you know, they still were adhering to the six only, but they were building there was one called a bulldog deck where you just use all of these different bulldog cards and just you run the board. It was insane.
What's happening there is the BattleTech original sin, right? Because remember, five free resources, and it works particularly well. So I mean, you had decks in the early days which were like Ullr decks, just playing, or Urban Mech decks. They would play two cost, just to finish their resource ramp early, and then just get all of these cheap units out. Once you add free deploy into the mix, you take it to a new level because you're drawing cards with hidden reserves, and then you're just throwing your stockpile at your opponent in the form of free deploy vehicles. That's the Bulldogs. It's the Galleon. It's the Saladin. It's all of these LM vehicles that cost no deployment. So you can save your deployments for playing resources and for playing hidden reserves. And that was what made them institute the 10 vehicle or 10 non-mech limits. You cannot have more than 10 cards in your deck that are 10 units in your deck that are not mechs, because they just banged up against the original sin and they didn't realize they were doing it.
Scrap on 5/6? Wasn't that Scrap on 6 when they first came out?
Yeah, with Scrap on 6, a lot of the cards still say Scrap on 6, but Vehicle Scrap on a 5 or 6. And again, this is another attempt to compensate for the original sin. Free deploy vehicles occupy a space in the design space. Remember, like, you can design any mech you want. You've got, like, you pay this many resources for structure, this many resources for armor, this many for attack, this many for speed. So there's like a four-dimensional space that you can operate in. And the zone in the design space that the vehicles in Arsenal have is a zone that's incredibly dangerous. And they hit it by accident. I genuinely believe they didn't understand what they were doing. And then they put in the 10 card limit and they put in the more like the 5 or 6 scrap as a way to paper over the problem. But yeah, there's so much good here.
Sometimes, you know, they leave the gate open and the cows get out.
That's right. And this is also the set where logistics starts to become, like, once you introduce a wide range of available free deploy units that cost logistics to hidden reserves, which costs logistics, you find that logistics becomes so much more valuable. Cool. Let's talk about missions. Missions, there's nothing. There's really nothing worthwhile except for one, Steel Talons. It's a Jade Falcon only rare mission. It is the only mission in Arsenal that is worth a damn. It's an auto include in any Jade Falcon deck if you have it. And finally, let's talk about commands. With commands, I'm just scanning through. There's a lot of interesting stuff. But there's one that stands, there's two. I have to name two. The first one is War Funds. War Funds is in every deck in the game. It's a common. It is a one resource card, tap for a resource, but also scrap to go hunting through your deck to find any resource. We have an optional errated version available because it is so powerful, because War Funds is always the right answer in every situation to what resources should I put in my deck. It's everywhere.
It's a broken card.
And the statement, yes, it's a broken card, but everybody can use it, is not one that holds in my book, because War Funds is a spike in the meta. And it's a spike that's available to everybody, so it's not a gigantic problem, but it's always the right choice. That's why War Funds as a common, you'll find selling for a lot of money, because it's every deck. The other card that I want to name, because it creates more gnashing of teeth than just about any other card I know, is Suicide Troops. Chester's laughing.
I love Suicide Troops. God,
Suicide
it's an incredibly
troops
fun.
Suicide Troops, let's read this card because you have to understand what's going on. It's an enhancement that goes on a vehicle. Usually you put it on a VTOL because it's for when you get unblocked and you don't want to be blocked. When you attack a site and you're not blocked, you put a counter on the site. During your opponent's repair reload phase, which is analogous to upkeep, for each counter on each site, it deals 2 damage to that site. So you put it on the stockpile, and now the person's taking 2 damage every round for each counter. If I attack twice, they're now taking 4 damage. Now, there is a technique for getting rid of them. You could tap any number of mechs to remove that many gorilla counters and scrap twice that many cards. So if there's a single gorilla counter, it's doing 2 damage every turn. And to get rid of it requires you to tap something and take another 2 damage.
It's a gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, you can drive opponents to despair with this thing.
Yep.
Lao Karita VTOL, decks with 12 VTOLs or something like that, that are designed around getting into play fast and getting the VTOLs on target fast, with missions like forged mission orders that will prevent blockers. It's rage inducing. And also an uncommon, right? Again, with the not so many rares. Okay. That brings us to Commander's Edition. So Commander's Edition primarily is a reprint of other sets. So I want to focus only on the cards that are substantially different. And the unit that I want to call out is the Spider Revised. The Spider Revised is an excellent, cheap, free, it's one of the only free deploy units that does 2 damage, and it's fast. And you can play it in any deck, and it's cheap. It's just an excellent mech. Spider Revised is a great choice for just to pepper into any old mech. And it's a common, so that's good. In terms of missions, let's see, are there any missions that were significantly changed? No, all the missions in Commander's Edition are from other sets, and none of them that are worth any that are worthwhile had any significant differences in them that I can think of. But there are some command cards that are worth looking at. Some command cards changed in their rules, like Inside Job, very importantly changed. It used to be that Inside Job allowed you to attack without being blocked that turn, which meant that if you put a Bearer of Mackenzie Hammer, which allows you to untap and re-attack and untap and re-attack as long as your dice rolling is good, you could use the Inside Job multiple times, boom, 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 boom. Doesn't work anymore. So you should be thinking about, and I'll put a link in the show notes to cards that changed significantly in Commander's Edition. But in terms of new cards, I think the Karitan High Command is fun. Karita High Command is a sort of a rare. It's not exactly a rare. It doesn't appear in boosters. It only appears in starters. It always appears in the Karita starter, but never anywhere else. And it allows you to turn your deck into a C3 deck. C3 is a fun little strategy that a lot of beginners think is overpowered, but turns out not to be. The C3 ability is simple. It simply says when you're attacking in a group containing at least one other unit with C3, then your unit with C3 and also the other unit with C3 get +2 attack. And so people go, oh, wow, +2 attack, that's a huge amount. But it's actually not that great. And the reason it's not that great, first of all, is that C3 as an ability costs a resource. So any mech with C3 costs one more than the same mech without C3. So you're paying for it, it's the first thing. And the second thing is that, remember how I talked about table intelligence, like understanding the decision space in the table? And if I attack with this, he'll block with that, and then that'll leave him open for this and that, blah, blah, blah. Once you get good at that, C3 decks start to become a problem because they're ridiculously easy to outmaneuver. Because the C3 player has a choice. He has to say, if I attack without the pairing up, then I'm paying extra resource for every mech for an ability that I'm not using. And I'm going to lose because my mechs are more expensive than they should be. But if I attack only in appropriate pairings or groupings, then I have cut out a wide swath of my decision space that I know my opponent knows I will not use. because it's inefficient. And so now you become so much more predictable. And for an opponent who understands how to take advantage of that predictability, you're relatively easy to beat. But with the Kuriden High Command giving you free C3 everywhere, right? You play a non-C3 deck, you shove it in there, and if you get C3, well, hey. And if you don't get C3, you don't. So it's a fun card. Which brings us to the last set, Crusade. Okay. Crusade units. What's good in Crusade units? Crusade has a decent range of solid units. I think I have to say the Hankyu Prime. Another one of those common cards that is guarded jealously because it works everywhere. Do you remember we talked about how munitions is not good? So a player who's building an advanced deck is either playing AT, ALT, or LT, and they're looking for mechs that are decent that don't have these extra buyouts. The Hankyu Prime only has an AT buyout, which means it's incredibly versatile, and it has ECM, which means you can pretend it's got one more armor. It's a 0-4-3 with ECM. It can be used by any clan, unlike the Fenris Prime, which is also an excellent 3-cost, 3-attack fast mech. The Hankyu Prime doesn't have a munitions buyout. It's so versatile. It's so useful. It's the right choice for a fast mech in almost every situation for clanners, which I typically am. Okay, missions. All right. Missions, I'm going to give you one good one. No, missions are good. I'm going to give you two good ones and one trap. Here are the two good ones. Force of Will. Force of Will gives you, if you have a pilot, gives you a huge amount of attack bonus and prevent one damage, which means it will score a kill and prevent a kill, right? It's incredibly sought after. It is a rare. It is one of the most sought after cards in the game. Similarly, Viper's Maw. Another rare card, only usable by Clansteel Viper, which is a terrible faction, but it's one of the things they really have going for them. Do you remember we talked about stalemating, about getting stuck in the situation where you're trying to create uneven trades, right? Viper's Maw is a card that makes uneven trades happen. Viper's Maw is, let's read it, choose up to two opposing untapped units that are not in the battle and force them to fight you. So if you attack with a large group and your opponent uses a chump blocker, you can pull in two more dudes, and now you've got an uneven trade and you can destroy all three of them for the cost of a mission. It's insanely good. And now the one trap card, Conquer. Everybody says, wow, Conquer, I get to take control of your cards? That sounds amazing. Doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because you have to lose initiative.
While attacking.
How do you lose initiative while attacking? If you have tactics in play and you're attacking and there's no blockers because you got the target, and if you've got tactics in play, and they probably have tactics in play as well, but you're going to win your initiative, right? So it's useless. If you don't have tactics in play, you can do this kind of if they have tactics in play by using jump after initiative has been determined. People have run around trying to make Conquer work. It just doesn't. It's got some like weird little uses, like taking control of a mech with Kai Champion of Solaris on it. If your opponent has Kai Champion of Solaris on it, on a mech, you attack the mech, you get to conquer the mech because Kai means they always win initiative. And then you get to take their mech and you get to take Kai with it. It's a fun little trick. Mark Roberts pointed it out. I hadn't seen it, but Conquer is generally speaking a trap. Don't use it.
Now, I'll intervene here on Conquer. As the game goes along, they introduce new things like an arsenal. They introduced vehicles. with Commander's Edition, they introduced high commands. They're introducing new things as they go along, similar to Magic. As they bring in new expansions, they bring in new keywords. One thing they brought in, they introduced here with Conquer, with the last one, was this whole idea of if you attack and you lose initiative, which is virtually impossible under extremely limited circumstances, you get this amazing, cool benefit, right? But why put that in there? Well, because I believe it is, just my personal opinion, but I believe that this was a forerunner, okay, that had they continued on, when the next expansion or two, there would have been cards that would have enabled you to lose initiative and get a really cool, you know, it's a power card, in other words. There were a number of other lose initiative cards in there, but it was basically designed for the defender. Okay, if you lose initiative,
steady fire.
Yeah, if you're defending, now all of a sudden, you know, you've got an extra bonus available to you that's not normally available, not available to attackers. So they're introducing this whole lose initiative thing, but for the attacker, there's this really wild thing. So this was something I believe that was coming on, like a number of other things. They never got around to arrow fighters. You know, we could go down a laundry list of stuff that they never got to because, you know, they didn't last long enough. But this was a rather unique kind of slided in there type thing.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So then we are on to commands. And for commands, I think the one that I want to call out is Hasty Alliance. Another rare, sorry to say. There's a lot of very valuable rares in the final expansion. Hasty Alliance is... it's an enabler, and it's an enabler that allows you to create decks that you could never create before. There are a lot of really weird and wacky unique cards in the game. Takashi Kurita is my personal favorite. We talked about him. But there are others. And the problem with building a deck around unique cards is that you don't know if you're going to get them or not. Hasty Alliance allows you to get them. When I talked about my Kurita, No You Cannot Attack Me deck while I build a corridor of fire, Hasty Alliance is required for that because it's required for me to find Takashi Kurita in my deck and get him out. Activate this card only if you have any unique command cards in play. Search your stockpile for any unique command card and put it into your command post for free. So this card is an enabler of weird and wacky stuff. So I'm a big fan of it.
All right. I think that we ran the gamut there.
Yeah. So there you go. That's all the sets in my
okay. So I have a couple I'll toss in for favorites. Gunslinger.
Gunslinger and Mercenaries.
Yes. Okay. This guy's he's slightly bigger than Cerberus. He costs one more, no buyouts, none. And he's who was he available for?
Kurita Steiner Davian.
Yeah, I mean, he's available for three out of the five, you know, factions there. He is good go.
An excellent backliner, also uncommon, and shouldn't be that hard to find.
My favorite fast mech in the game is just the, I believe it's the Fenris Prime. He's a 1/6, does 3 damage, and costs how much to get him out?
3 plus 1 A plus 1 M plus 1 T.
Yep. So he is an AMT guy. It costs 3 to get him out, but he does 3 damage, which is enough to be effective, but he's also a 1/6. He's got 7. So he's at that magic number that it's hard to take him out in one time. You usually get 2 or 3 turns out of him for not a lot, and he's a common.
It's worth noting. This brings up an interesting point. Sure. So in a modern deck that has all cards available to it, the Fenris Prime is almost never the right choice. The Hunkyu Prime is the right choice. Because remember what we said about munitions, right? Because if you can give up munitions, and if you have a wide enough mech selection that giving up munitions doesn't make it too difficult for you to find mechs in the places that you want to find them, then giving up munitions is worth your time. In the limited era of the game, when only the limited and Counter-Strike were out, for example, you couldn't pass up munitions. There simply wasn't enough card variety to allow you to have a decent mix selection, especially if you were the clans, without munitions, right? Munitions comes from LRMs and it comes from autocannons primarily. Autocannons are the things that give you alpha strike. But in the early game, like if you look at who won the very first World Champs, Peter Sundholm with a Wolf deck, which was an AMT deck. It was a fast mech hunting deck. A lot of the cards in that deck wouldn't be played today because you just want to, if you can give up M, you should.
No argument there. It's just if you're going to play a deck with M in it, yep. This is a solid candidate for your fast screen.
Right.
Another thing I want to bring there are a number of Steel Viper mechs that are just phenomenal. I can't think of the names of them right now, but I think of
the crossbows.
Oh my gosh, crossbows are insane. Yeah,
this is worth mentioning. The last World Championships was 2001, but the last heavily attended World Championships was 2000. And the winner of the 2000 World Champs used an invading clans deck. So we didn't mention alliances, which are a new feature in Crusade, which allow you to do sort of multi-faction decks. So he had a deck that could use all, they give you a penalty as well. So it's not just cheese. But the invading clans deck was a tactics logistics deck. It wasn't ALT, it was LT. And it used Viper's Maws and it used merchant cast to get down improved construction facilities. And it had to face the problem, if I don't include assembly, what clan mechs can I use? Because almost all clan mechs use assembly, certainly almost all the good ones. And it drew heavily on Steel Viper's crossbows, which did not require assembly. So it's worth looking at that deck and trying to understand how it works. I would argue it abuses merchant cast. We've talked about that already. But yeah. You don't have to stick with the basics. There are some weird things you can do.
And this is a nice thing just about the whole system itself. On the surface, it seems pretty cut and dried. You choose different factions. You put mechs into the factions. Some of them are generic. Some of them are specific to each faction, and so you can build decks for each faction and have a different flavor out of each one. But there are also ways to mix and match because you got generics that can go across all the different factions, and each time you put a certain generic card into a specific faction, it seems to do something different because of the flavor of the faction. And so all this diversity is there to do a lot of things, and to me that's a large part of why this game just doesn't get old. It's not like strictly it's not five colors and that's it. There's eight different factions and you can cram a lot of different things into them. And with the alliances, which they another thing, you know, again, that they're trying out, another keyword card to, you know, expand the base, allowed you to mix and match some of the factions even. And so this great diversity of the card game is reflective of the whole entire universe of Battletech, which has gone on for 35 years, which is just, there's all this lore, there's all these stories, there's all these mechs, there's all of this just rich texture to this entire universe. Battletech CCG is a very good reflection of that. And when you're playing the game, when you're slinging the cards, you drop one out there and you see the faction icon on it as it drops on the table, the feel of the whole thing comes across you and it's just very addictive and it's very easy to fall in love with.
Yeah, the thematic heft of the game, if you contrast it to Magic, which is, of course, its closest relative, the thematic heft of the game is something that Magic just doesn't have, because Magic didn't have a pre-existing universe and a pre-existing lore. They kind of made it up on the side, and the lore in the universe has never been that important to the players of Magic, mm-hmm.
right?
Compared to the cards themselves. But with BattleTech, because you tap into the lore of this incredibly rich universe, it spices the gameplay. You can try to build decks that are based on scenarios from the lore, right? You can do, I don't know, Jade Falcons at 2K'd, and then you can have Aiden. Well, you can't have Aiden Pride because he's not in the game, but you can have Pride in there, and you can have some comp star in there, and you can face him off against Anastasius Focht, who, by the way, is a terrible card unless you're playing against Clanners. So great to put in a scenario deck, not great to put in a regular deck. But there's all sorts of ways to add spice and flavor.
That's a good sideboard card, maybe.
He's not bad as a sideboard card. I don't know if he's that good. I'm not that good at sideboarding. Huh. If Peter were here, he would tell us the answer to that.
Well, let's dive into the kind of idea of the factions and kind of what are some favorite factions, what are dominant factions, kind of what are factions. You know, you mentioned that the Steel Viper, I think it was, that just kind of fall flat.
Let's see. So let's start with the clans because they're easy. So you've got five clans: Wolf, Jade Falcon, Ghost Bear, Smoke Jaguar, and Little Baby Steel Viper, introduced in the final expansion. So forget Steel Viper. Right, Steel Viper has got a couple of cards. It would have had a lot more, I'm sure, but it's only got a couple of cards. Now, some of them are very good, right? Paragard Zalman, the unique, is excellent. Viper's Maw is excellent, but they're generally better when played in an invading clans deck with the other clans. So they're not really... You can have some fun with them, but they're not that interesting. The Smoke Jaguars are the next to go. The Smoke Jaguars just don't do anything well except missiles. They do missiles well, but missiles aren't very good. So I have a Smoke Jaguar missile deck. I use it as a teaching deck. It's fun. It's not going to win any prizes, right? Kind of fun. It functions okay. But most people don't find there's a lot of flavor in Smoke Jaguar, which leaves the remaining three: Wolf, Jade Falcon, and Ghost Bear.
Ghost Bear.
And I would say of those, the Wolf are the most competitive. They've also got a lot of rich cards. They love to go for speed hunting. The Jade Falcons are the next most competitive. They love their elementals. They have cards like Steel Talons. They're okay. They're decent. I love playing them, but I wouldn't send them to a tournament. And the Ghost Bears are also fun, and you can do a lot with them, but again, like, they won't reach great heights. Only the Wolves and the Jade Falcons, I would say, are tournament viable. The Smoke Jags aren't fun. The Ghost Bears are fun. The Steel Vipers are what you'd get if you took a clan generic. If you want to build a Steel Viper deck, build a clan generic concept deck and then throw in a little bit of spice. So for example, I have a Steel Viper deck. I use it with the combo of Warrior Cast and Sibco Allegiance, which are two clan generic cards that allow you to basically get a lot of fun out of your pilots. Warrior Cast, Sibco Allegiance, and Star Commander. And those three cards are clan generic. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll toss this into Steel Viper and add a little bit of spice, and that's it. So those are the clans. Going to the Inner Sphere, Chester, do you have strong opinions? Otherwise, I can rattle them off as well.
Karita and Steiner have a wider variety of specific cards that are, you know, just specific to them. I think a better quality of cards that are available specific to them than the other houses. Merrick has a very wide variety of all different kinds of things. There's so many cards that have the Merrick stamp on them. They share them with others, but that's a reflection of the lore. Liao is very narrow in its mech, or it's really good mech assortment, but you know, you put some good generics in there and Liao can come out. It's very hard to make a Liao deck, though. They are the tricky guys. They want the politics in there. They have got all kinds of stuff that do that, but you go heavy on politics, it makes you go light on mechs, and if you don't have, you know, a lot of really good stuff to go in there, then you got a problem. Davian is kind of like your all-purpose. They've got a lot of good mechs. They've got a lot of good missions. They've got a lot of good personalities. they're kind of like a jack of all trades. They do most things well, but there's not a lot of things that they do extremely well. So that's kind of your inner sphere.
Let me tackle some of those, because I happen to disagree on some of them.
What?
I haven't. Well, you're shocked.
I'm shocked.
Right. Okay. So I would say that the most newbie friendly factions in the inner sphere are Steiner and Davian. It's hard to build a poor Steiner or Davian deck. They have, as you say, they've got a wide range of things that are available to them. They've got a couple of chase cards that you just love to get out, like getting Kai Allard Lau out, always fun. Getting Prince Victor Steiner Davian out, always fun, right? And you can say, oh, this is one unique, but it's always great when he comes out. Super good. Melissa Steiner Davian, and they both got great mech selection. Karita,
don't downplay Adam Steiner.
I will downplay Adam Steiner again and again.
Yep, that's terrible. All right. You go right ahead. He untaps a mech.
Yeah, always, but he requires helpful. P. Nice. He requires P, I think.
Oh, he didn't require... no, not the P thing again.
Yeah, if he were only required tactics, he would be great. But you don't want to layer politics into a combat deck necessarily if you can avoid it. Okay, so Steiner Davian, easy to do well. Karita, harder. It's hard to understand really what Karita stands for. You might say C3, but I'm not so, like, C3 is a fairly good generic concept. Karita's got a lot of mechs that don't use assembly. So if you're looking for a deck that won't have assembly because you're doing something like LM or LMP for whatever trick you've got up your sleeve, Karita's not a bad place to go for that. But I find it difficult to make a Karita deck come together. The third place getter in the 2000 World Champs, after first place Invading Clans and second place Star League, was a Karita deck based around a not particularly Karita themed situation. He used strategic bombardment to destroy resources. And he just happened to decide that because he was doing LM, it turned out that the Karita mech mix was better. So he picked Karita, but it didn't feel Karita-ish. Lau has a very strong but very narrow theme, which is dirty tricks, right? Play politics and do dirty tricks as for the entire duration of the game. That's all you do. Like, you do have mechs, of course, right? Because you can't just leave your stockpile open. But playing dirty tricks is your raison d'etre. Lau often requires a fair amount of access to rare cards. It's not a forgiving faction.
No, right? It's not something you can play, it's not something you can make a deck that will win most of the time without politics.
You can do politics, but the point is that having gotten politics, you're now trying to find the right dirty tricks. And most of the Lao-based dirty tricks that actually work, like Mech Recall, Manipulation of Romano, Maskarovka Operatives, they're rares.
Well, yes.
You'll need to trade for them. Merrick, I find, is kind of like Karita, only more so. I find that Merrick decks don't really come together very easily. The Merrick Gorge Master deck that got highly placed in one of the World Champs is another example, like the Karita deck I mentioned, of taking a few cards here and there and making it work. Merrick has an excellent Commander's Edition revised mech, the Anvil revised. It's an exceptional mech. It's a 5-cost AT. Again, notice one of the things that makes it great, it doesn't require munitions. And it's like 2/6/4 with ECM moderate. It's kind of like the Man of War Prime, but a bit more of a pain in the butt to use. I find that it's hard to make Merrick decks come together. So that's the core five. Do you want to talk about the last three? Comstar, Snives, and Rasselhag.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it's hard.
Rasselhag is difficult because it's very narrow. They've only got like there's no mechs.
There's no mechs. They've got one card.
They have about four individual character cards. They've got one resource and one mission, and that's it.
So the resource is all about putting resources on bonus resources on command cards, which is So Rasselhag feels like it's pointing you at artillery, right?
Yes, very much.
Or at Corridor of Fire style decks. They have this exceptional unique, which is really weird. 3/4 M3P. So she's an MP, Tyra Miriborg. She taps to deal a structure damage, whatever. The point is, you can remove her from the game to take a whole extra turn, skipping the missions phase. So, for example, if you're building up a gigantic Corridor of Fire and you're about to die, and all you just need is for your Corridor of Fire to get enough tokens on it to reveal it, and then just go boom, then that would work. But it's like the card that gets people dreaming, but it's really hard to make work in practice. So I would say, forget Rasselhag, just do what I did with Steel Viper, which is to take a principle that's generic, shove a little bit of Rasselhag flavor on it, and then punt it into that.
The other one is Comstar. And yeah. Comstar is actually an interesting faction to use. Early on in the game, there were a couple of cards that were found, like Mongoose. Everybody was putting Mongoose
in. Mongoose was exceptional mech from Limited.
Everywhere. Everybody had them in their decks. Later on, they realized, oh, wait, this shouldn't be a generic card. This should be a Comstar-only card.
So in Commander's Edition, it's reprinted as Comstar only. And that is the governing rule.
Yep, and there happened with, there was the Hussar, which was a free-to-play fast also. So there were a couple of cards that when they got taken out of the generic area, they got put into Comstar, and which kind of upped the game a little bit for them. But they're twitchy, Comstar is. They've got a number of large fatties, but they've got some interesting things. Like I said, that's how I won my deal was with the Comstar Deep Agent.
Well,
and then what was the other one we're missing?
Sandhurst Royal Military Academy, which I encourage nobody to use.
What was the other faction we're missing?
Oh, hold on. Let's talk about that for a second. So Sandhurst Royal Military Academy is a deck winner, is a tournament winner when combined with free deploy decks. So the combination was free deploy units, hidden reserves, Sandhurst Royal Military Academy, and Star League. Star League was there because it allowed you to get a much better selection of free deploy units. And this deck just blitzes tournaments to the point where, as I've said before, like, set it aside. Everybody knows it works. Nobody wants, we don't want you to, you know, don't bring it to the table anymore. But Sandhurst Royal Military Academy, which we do have an errated version of, by the way, is a Comstar card. And without it, the Comstar faction feels a lot weaker.
Yep.
Which brings us to St. Ives.
Oh, St. Ives. Again, no mechs. No mechs for St. Ives. So
not enough cards to build a theme out of.
There's not. And then there's the one that you may have forgotten was the Novacat.
No. You're thinking Wolf's Dragoons, but that was... Novacat's not in the game.
There's a mech that has... Oh. There's one mech that has a Novacat thing on it.
No, it doesn't. It's called the Novacat. That's not true. What you do have with St. Ives, you have a couple of cards that are particularly, like, they get your mind thinking. One of those is Dropship Intercept, which is a mission. Play if you are the defending player and don't have any blockers, deplete all attacking mechs at the end of the mission. So if you can lure your attacker into attacking with a bunch of dudes and you can take the lump, then you can deplete them all, which means they won't untap on his next turn. The other one that's particularly, the one that I use for my St. Ives deck, my St. Ives deck is a deck with arms reduction and work stoppage. Work stoppage. When you activate this card, choose any asset. Players with that asset available may not ignore asset costs specifying that asset, which includes you. So you could say, for example, so arms reduction means that people can't spend more than 2 resources any turn building stuff. And on top of that, you could do a work stoppage on assembly, which means that all of their mechs, you have to pay the assembly buyout. Right? So now, not only do you have fewer resources to use, everything's more expensive. So there are things you can do with St. Ives, but it's a very limited faction. You thought Lao was limited, St. Ives is even more.
Very much so.
It was a shadow cat or a Nova cat.
And it was it had a Steel Viper on it. It was the only, and we never see Steel Viper again until Conquer.
Oh, Shadow Cat is in Arsenal, and it's the So you're right. Steel Viper is introduced in Arsenal, not in Crusade. There are two cards: the Shadow Cat A and B were Steel Viper cards. It was weird.
It's just weird. So that was just another one of those little hint type things that we're not limited on all the clans, because there's like, you know, 20 different clans. We're not limiting all the clans here to just these four major ones. They were throwing things out there, little bits here and little bits there, where they were going to expand them, you know, later on. It's not like they just dropped the ball on this and decided, you know, they didn't have any plans for it. They had plans to expand this thing out. They had different card types, different mechanics, different factions. There were so many different things that they could have done if they had just, you know, continued on with it. And that's the shame part of this that breaks our hearts, is that this game could have gone so much farther and done so much more many things. A number of hints here and there, you know, that were dropped for, you know, things to look for in the future, that just never happened.
You guys have talked, you know, off and on about tournaments. You know, are there still tournaments that go on? You know, are there gaming conventions where people are meeting up, you know, self-organized?
Okay. So tournaments. So first of all, if you want a tournament, you probably need at least 8 people to start with.
Right.
And if you get 8 people and everybody agrees to show up and everybody actually shows up, you could probably do a tournament. You probably want to do a drafting tournament to start with, because the problem with tournaments is that the meta was left in a spiky state, right? There are a number of cards that have issues. So the first thing, if you want to play a constructed tournament, the first thing you have to do is either ban or errata about 8 or 9 cards to smooth things out. And so now your challenge is find a group of players willing to accept that errata, because remember, there's nobody in charge, right? There's only general agreements. I have considered setting up some sort of tournament with sort of the erratas as we wrote them, and the problem is, you know what? It might work now. I don't think it would have worked 2 years ago when I was last trying it, but it might work now online.
That's one way of doing it.
Over the course of months.
Another way of doing it, and we saw this in our Bay Area tournament, or in our, not necessarily a tournament, but a group, okay? If you can get a group together, one way to do all the problem with trying to do tournaments, especially with drafts, is that the cost would be really prohibitive.
You need
sealed product. Because of how much an individual booster is going to cost you. And, you know, every day that goes by, you know, unopened boosters, that dwindles, you know, a ton. One thing I came up with here last year was the idea, and I don't know why I didn't think of it before, is to take the idea of the magic cube. Are you familiar with that concept?
No.
Okay, so what you do is you take one of, say, 800 different cards, or you get 800 cards and all of them are completely different. This is a way for you to maximize the playability of your entire collection. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you create this cube of these 800, 900, 1200 cards, however many you want. You then take all these cards and you mix them all up and you create 15 card boosters. Okay, and then so depending on how many people you have around the draft, you hand them a box, and each box has got 3 boosters in it. Okay, this is called a cube. And we did it, we set this up, I threw that out there. I thought, guys, you know, why hadn't we thought about this before? So I set it out there, and I showed up with mine, and another guy showed up with his. And I had mine, I did a certain way, he did his a different way. We wound up doing both of them. They were both a smash hit. I mean, they're just, it's phenomenal, a great way to play. So if you have a play group of at least six, okay, I heartily recommend throwing together a cube. There's a number of ways to do it. Can we send him the two little boxes I made up
Say we'll put it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. So you can figure it out for yourself. It's very simple. It's a little time consuming, to put it together, but once you've got it there, boom, you're set. Absolute most fun you'll have playing BattleTech in a group.
So there, to put a little bit of extra detail in this, there are various types of cubes. So the simplest version of a cube is you take, I would recommend 45 cards per player, or maybe 60 cards. Let's say 45 cards per player. So that means 180 cards for a 4-player or 360 cards for an 8-player.
Yep.
No resources. And then you have a pile of resources on the side that people can grab whatever they need. And then you separate that as out into boosters, and you either hand over 3 boosters or 4 if you're doing like 60 cards. Or you can really drop the boosters, right? Now, the next level of this is that you want to put some thought into the design of your cube. So you could start off just shoving 360 random cards in there. But actually, you want a certain ratio of mechs to commands to missions. And if you're asking people to abide by, like, you're either a clanner or an inner sphere player, so at a basic level, you don't have any faction limits. You can play clan mechs, inner sphere mechs, whatever, right? But you could ask people to play clan or inner sphere, in which case you need to make sure that the ratios are right. You need to make sure that you don't have too many fast mechs and too few slow mechs, or not too many slow mechs and too few fast mechs. So choosing the cards that go into your cube, that's where people actually often spend a lot of time.
And I have that on my little deal, my little matrix that I made up. So for each booster, for example, okay, you've got, there's two kinds of boosters. In each box, you get 2 mech boosters and 1 non-mech booster. So a non-mech booster would have 3 resource cards, 8 mission cards, and 4 command cards. That would be your 15-card booster for that. For the mechs, each one would have 3 fast mechs, 4 moderate mechs, 5 slow mechs, and 1 and 3 different vehicles in the speeds as well.
Right.
Okay, and so you have 2 of those boosters, and so now it's 2/3 mechs, 1/3 not. And from there, once you do your draft and whatnot, you wind up with very very playable decks. They're a lot of fun. Like I said, we had more fun than we've ever had before. It was great.
Everybody there are a lot of cards that won't show up in any self-respecting constructed deck, but that still do pretty well in a draft. Because the power level is lower.
And I'm curious, I had found a super cheap auction where I got a couple sealed boxes recently. The guy didn't label the auction very well, and so nobody really saw it. So it was a bunch of boxes, but I had filmed the opening of one, which I'll get to edit and I'll post up eventually. But I'm curious,
what were the sets?
It was 2 limited, 1 Counter-Strike.
Okay, so the cheap stuff.
Yeah, the cheap stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
But it got filmed, and so there's basically a record there of what was actually what those boosters were, and so there's a way that you could kind of reconstruct that box if someone films what they opened for a box to see what the actual packs were, and then you could take those packs into a tournament. Six players, 6 packs, and
I don't think it's worth the time. If you think about whether you're going to spend your time on deconstructing or reverse engineering some sort of algorithmic thing about how booster packs are randomly constructed, or you could craft a cube that has a lot of good options for players. I think your time is better spent on the latter.
Yeah, like we said, there's about a quarter of the cards that aren't worth playing ever under any circumstances, including...
Draft comes in, right? Because you're forced to play them. You have to work with what you got.
Or you're bad luck, for sure. But again, the cubes just end up being more enjoyable. And the other thing about a cube is that when you're done with a cube, you don't have to, to regenerate a cube is not that hard,
right?
It'll take you 15 minutes to put everything back into boosters. But if you're doing like these algorithms and these randomizations, it's a ton of work.
You know, that would be a good document for the show notes. You know, if I have a couple of cubes were generated, or a couple, you know, a dozen or so, and that could be shared, and people could draw from that document to create their kind of draft cubes.
We'll see what we can do. Yeah. I'm not sure we have that stuff lying around right now, but it's what worth making.
What was the other guy's name?
Carlo. Carlo has a cube. So maybe we can get his cube list in the show notes.
If we could get his cube list in the notes,
that's probably a good idea.
Yeah, that would be excellent. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, guys, we've gone over a lot, and I think we've kind of wrapped up there. Yeah, so I'll definitely, probably split this up into two, because 3.5 hours is a little long for most people.
We'll break off our talks into three.
Yeah, but it was great, and I'm happy to kind of come back if you guys are interested in kind of talking more if we get good response to this.
I gotta say, I'm sad that we missed Peter. I think there's a lot of stuff that that he still could contribute to additional discussion topics. I'm sure this is not the last time we're going to do it. What I'd really like to see, I think next time, is I'd like to see Peter, Mark, and Gustav. In a room about old times, because there what you have is you have things that neither Chester nor I can bring to the table, which is the combination of A, exceptionally high skill, and B, having been in the center of it all, right? I flatter myself I'm a pretty good player. I was in the periphery. Chester, pretty good player as well, also in the periphery, not really going to, like,
we were you had your brush with
Peter. What?
We were, that my brush, yeah. Okay, we were not there. If you weren't there at the Worlds, and I believe that most of them were there for all of them, were they not?
I don't know about Peter, but I'm pretty sure that Gustav and Mark made it to basically every single one.
Yeah, there's a generational knowledge is a phrase we usually use for that type of thing that's there in that little brain trust that, neither Michael or I, can bring to the table.
Yeah, if we could bring back Peter, if we could bring back Terry, if we could bring back a number of these guys, so Mark and Gustav are the two who came back, right? I spent a lot of effort after the Yahoo group died. I've got an archive of the Yahoo group, by the way, but I put in a lot of effort in trying to find people who still had nostalgia and just have them join the Facebook group. I didn't care if they talked. I would just wanted them to join so that they could see that people were still talking about it. And if they felt an interest in continuing the conversation, they were, they were a mouse click away from typing whatever they wanted. And we got a number of, I was very happy when we got Gustav back. I think he lives on some little island somewhere. And getting Mark, who's from the UK. And if only, Cab and Terry and Peter and folks came back to be more active, that would be great. Although it's funny. I wanted to make sure to bring this up because I think it's an interesting aspect of the hobby, of the fandom. I don't know what you want to call it. We seem to break down into three different types of Battletech CCG players. There are the statics, the evolvers, and the revolutionaries. The statics are the folks who are basically perfectly happy with the game as it is. A lot of them are folks who had a lot to do with the game in its heyday and who primarily view playing Battletech CCG as a return to an old friend, right? Who they might come back to every now and then. You have the revolutionaries who are folks who would really like to see the game's mistakes corrected or fixed by sort of rebuilding it from the ground up, right? There was recently a post about this new game called Redline There are folks who are trying to build their own BattleTech card game with inspiration from the BattleTech CCG, but these folks generally think that some of the problems that I brought up, like the issue with the original sin problem, or the fact that the assets are so unbalanced, or that command cards just aren't that good, are things that cannot be solved except at the by tearing apart the basic rule set, which has the side effect of forcing you to throw away the existing cards, right? And then there are the third group of folks who are the evolution folks. I think both Chester and I fall into that category, and we can talk about the consequences of that some other time. But folks who believe that there is a way to carry the game forward without significantly changing the core rule set, and with still allowing you to play the old cards without having to rebuild it from scratch, but also not willing to accept that the state of the game as it was left in 2001, for example, with Sandhurst Royal Military Academy not banned or errated, is fine, and that's just the way it is. So the way those folks break down is really interesting, and I've always enjoyed having that debate with people.
Well, I mean, I think there's going to be good response. Just kind of looking at the Facebook group and, you know, the interest people had when I kind of mentioned this, and your kind of question that you float out there for, you know, getting some kind of Twitch streams of games or whatnot going. You know, I'll definitely be doing it. You know, I'll be kind of posting some other videos. I was planning to kind of get a channel started. I was going to call it a Renegade HPG. And so that's where this will be. And so at Renegade HPG on Instagram, and I'll probably make a Facebook group page as well. But yeah, I'll definitely reach out to those guys to try to get conversations. You know, I would love to hear stories about kind of in the heyday and that perspective, but it would be awesome.
And you said you're going to put this up on YouTube?
Yep, I'll put this up on YouTube. Okay. I'll name the channel.
I don't do Instagram, so I wouldn't even know how to get there.
And there you go. Well, this whole video, I'll edit it. I'll cut it into a couple parts. You know, we'll be up on YouTube, and I'll put some other stuff up there as well. Do you guys have any you know, other than the BattleTech CCG page and the BattleTech CCG trade and sell page, any kind of links that you guys want to toss out there?
Let's go back over the basic tools that you have. You have the BattleTech CCG Facebook group. You have the BattleTech CCG Trade and Sell Facebook group, which I set up because there was a website that allowed you to list your sets and to sort of do automatic matching mm-hmm. between users, but that's disappeared. It was called Trade Cards Online. So if you want to do something like listing all the cards that you have and all the cards that you want, and then bumping that listing every month or something, do that in the BattleTech CCG Trade and Sell group. So there's two Facebook groups. Then there is the two techniques for playing online, Lackey and Tabletop Simulator. And then there are the core toolkits that you want to do, that you want to be using offline. There's Mordell's Deck Builder, if you want to do good filtering for the basic game. I highly recommend it. You can find it in the files of the Facebook group. And there is the BattleTech Card List Excel spreadsheet, now on version 5, which is an excellent spreadsheet for cataloging your own cards.
And I use, you know, I have, just for BattleTech fans in general, there's the Helm Memory Core document that's out there. I don't even remember where it is, but that's where I kind of have my card list for the card game. But it also has pretty much every BattleTech product that's been made, cool. Which is kind of a good, so, you know, between all those, people can find what they need. But in the Facebook group documents, we'll put a lot of these key ones that we talked about in the show notes, but definitely the documents on the Facebook group
are key. Read the announcements.
I've been reading through them as well. There's a lot there, so there's some great information. But
once you've gone through all of this, I hope that as you go through it, that you'll write down some questions that occurs to you as you're going through it that you didn't occur this time, and so the next time we come on, please feel free to ask us some specific questions about specific things.
I will. I definitely will. And I definitely had a plan for some, you know, FAQ on this, but you know, we don't want to hit the 4-hour mark necessarily.
I should mention there's a huge amount of content on the Facebook group in terms of like tactical discussions and decks of the week from, and I'm talking about 2017, 2018. You scroll back in the group and you will see a lot of a lot of advice, a lot of tactics, a lot of deck lists, and a lot of random chit chat, of course, as well. But there's some great series out there, especially from Mark Roberts with his Deck of the Week. I did a short series on basic tactics. There's a lot of good content.
Awesome. Well, that's good, guys. Well, let's wrap up there. And, also I'll say if people that are listening have those questions, put those in the comments, you know, and we can all kind of interact and kind of answer those as we go. Chester, what was?
One last item I'll toss up. We have 567 members on our Facebook, on the BattleTech CCSU Facebook page. There's 550 people out there that are paying attention. Some of them more than others. As usual, there's not as many that comment, but you know, please come on by, say hi, or just hang out.
Yeah, and even just kind of mention kind of where you're at, located, and people can find each other.
If you read the announcements, you will find we have a Google map going, which allows people to put their location. Obviously, it's optional, but we've had at least one situation where I saw someone post, "Hey, there's a guy near me that I didn't know about. Let's set up some live games." So we've made at least one friendship.
One connection. Yeah, I put mine on there, but I think it was 300 miles to the next player. So if we can get more of those 500 people on there, I'm sure that'll fill out that area a little bit.
That'd
more.
Great.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, guys. We'll definitely circle back around and have more conversations like this.
This has been great fun.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Yep.
All right, BattleTech fans, that is a wrap for the first episode, part two of Renegade HPG podcast. If you like that, please don't forget to give it a little thumbs up, like, and subscribe to the channel if you want to catch more content as it comes out. And if you have any questions, certainly about the game that we didn't cover, put them down in the comments. And we'll be kind of looking at those. And if we can answer to kind of fill in any gaps in the information about gameplay, we'd be happy to do that for you guys. So thanks again for watching. And we'll catch you on the next episode.